Whoa, sure.
No, wait a minute. I might need that later.
Okay.
First coffee pot.
All right.
Squire, please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. Trustee Kopisch?
Here.
Trustee Gingrich?
Here.
Trustee Green?
Here.
Trustee Vandenhoven is here. Trustee Dart?
Here.
Trustee Gast is excused. Trustee Zeller?
Here.
Are there any modifications to the agenda this evening? Suggested? Anyone visiting who'd like to see an item moved up or down on the agenda? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the agenda as submitted? Trustee Kopisch, second. Trustee Gingrich, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Are there any announcements? Hearing none, we'll move on to item four, presentation and approval and possible approval of the initial survey of historic sites in the Village of Alloway.
Thank you. My name is Jody Rose. I work at the Wisconsin Historical Society in Madison, and this project was funded by the National Park Service with a grant through my office, which we passed through to the Village of Alloway. And I'd like to express the gratitude to Tracy for the great job that she did administering the grant. Anytime you're dealing with federal monies, process can be somewhat cumbersome, and she did a great job of getting the bills paid on time, so I'd like to thank her for that. I'd like to talk a little bit about what this survey is and what it isn't. As I mentioned, this money came from the National Park Service, and they administer a program called the National Register of Historic Places. It's the country's official list of significant properties. They pass off the administration of the program to each of the individual states. So while they oversee the program in the state of Wisconsin, my office is the office that administers the National Register in Wisconsin. And we're headquartered in the Wisconsin Historical Society building, which is right on the UW campus. Please don't visit us now because it's all under construction out in front of our building. It's kind of a maze to get into our building. I expect a piece of cheese every time I get into the front door of our building. If you haven't had a chance, though, to come visit us, please do, at least on the website. And in the back, I have some bookmarks, which have our web address, which was wisconsinhistory.org. And a lot of our collections are available online. We are a national and international leader in what we do. We have the best map collection of North America found anywhere. You need something dating back to the 1500s? Come to us. We have the second largest newspaper collection in the country, second only to the Library of Congress. We're also a genealogical mecca with the folks in Salt Lake City. If you're researching your family tree, we have pretty much everything that you need to do that. We operate series of historic sites around the state. Old World Wisconsin outside of Milwaukee is probably our most well-known, but we have other ones scattered around. We work with school groups and local historical societies around the state, well over 300 of them. My piece of the pie is dealing with the National Register of Historic Places. Like I mentioned, the National Register is the country's official list of significant properties. The reason we funded this survey was specifically to identify properties for listing in the National Register. Now, the final survey that you received, it can be used for other purposes. It can be used for educational purposes, tourism, variety of purposes. But the reason our office funded this was to identify properties that are eligible for the National Register. That's the foremost point of the survey. The National Register to get listed in the National Register. That's pretty strict rules. First of all, property has to be at least 50 years old. Now you're going to go, oh, Alloway has lots of buildings over 50 years old. That's true. That's the minimum requirement. Property has to be at least 50 years old to be considered historic as set by the National Park Service. So you got a building that's over 50 years old, and I'm going to refer to just buildings. Archaeological sites are also eligible for listing in the National Register, but this project only looked at above-ground resources. So if the property is no longer there, if it's now an archaeological site, that was beyond the purview of this project. Doesn't mean it can't be looked at in the future, but we didn't have the time or the expertise to look at archaeological sites. So I'm going to speak specifically about buildings. So the property has to be at least 50 years old to be considered historic. Then it has to have historic integrity. That's a fancy way of saying, does the building still look like it did when it was originally constructed or when it was identified as an important event happening there? Properties that are artificially sited almost always do not qualify for the National Register. Now, there's always going to be exceptions, but they're exceptions, so I'm not going to get into the minutiae of the program. So if a property is artificially sited, it's almost always not going to qualify for listing in the National Register. If it has a front porch that's been filled in and now is a three-season porch or a family room or something, that's a pretty big integrity hit. The property owner, if he came back to life, would look, what did they do to my front porch? It has all these windows across it now. That's a hit on its integrity. Historic windows are a key component of any type of architecture. And if you start to shorten those windows, replace those windows, that's also an integrity hit. So any or all of these can make a property not eligible for listing in the National Register. So even if a building's 50 years old, if it starts having these changes to it, makes it not eligible for the National Register. Doesn't mean it doesn't have an important story to be told. It's just that the National Register is not the vehicle to tell that story. Then the big kicker is it has to be significant. Not only has to be old, it has to be at least 50 years old, has to have good integrity, it has to be significant, meaning it rises above its peers. So if you're saying a building is significant as a type of Queen Anne architecture, Queen Anne style was popular between the 1890s and 1910, it has to not only have all the characteristics of that style, but it has to stand out amongst its peers in the community. And that's the big thing. You know, what we hear all the time, nothing against the village president, but I'll commonly hear that, oh, the mayor used to live here. Well, the mayor was popular. He got elected. It doesn't mean he did anything significant.
Amen to that.
Plus, to be significant, you have to be dead. So.
Amen to that, too.
But I mean, so that's again how the National Register looks at things. Like I said, I get frequent calls from people. The mayor used to live here, and I said, well, what did they do while they were mayor? So, there are four different criteria we use to identify properties as being significant. A property can be significant for the role they played in the history of the community. This is an example of a public library in Jefferson County. It was listed in the National Register because it was historically important. This was the first library in the community, and it still serves the library, but it was listed because of the role it played in the educational history of the community. And again, it still looks like it did when it was constructed in 1902. When I talk about the historic integrity, I mean the exterior of the building. The National Register is interested in what is viewable by the public. So the interior, this one has a very nice intact interior, but to be listed in the National Register, the interior doesn't get looked at that often. Property can also be significant for its association with important people. And again, the people that live there or work there have to be significant. They have to have done something that set them apart from their peers. Popularity is not a criteria. Science Hall on the UW campus, some of the major contributions in geological education have been uncovered at Science Hall. This is where the events took place. The building still looks like it did when it was constructed. That's why it's historically significant for its association with Van Hise and Chamberlain. Most buildings get listed in the National Register for their architectural significance because that's kind of the easiest thing to see. You can look at a building and say, oh, that has all the characteristics of whatever the architectural style is, and it stands out amongst it. The Cotton House at Heritage Hill is listed in the National Register because it's a phenomenal example of Greek Revival architecture. It's built in the 1840s, and which is very early for the state of Wisconsin. We weren't a state until 1848, so there wasn't a lot of building going on then. And to have a building of this magnitude still around, still looking like it does, like it did, that's why it was listed in the National Register. These surveys that we fund look at properties for listing in the National Register either by themselves, because they're individually important, or because the neighborhood is important. And when we say a historic district, it's a neighborhood. When you go to one of these districts, you get a sense that you're stepping into something distinctive. A commercial district is very easy to identify because that's where all the historic retail businesses took place. So it's pretty easy to identify the boundaries of that. A residential neighborhood's a little harder to identify as being significant as a historic district as outlined by the National Register. The buildings should all be from a same time period. They should have similar setbacks. They should be similar size and scale. You should have a sense that when you walk into one of these neighborhoods that you're stepping into something distinctive. There shouldn't be many buildings with a lot of artificial siding in these historic districts. It should be like it was when it was originally constructed. There may be some modern buildings, there may be some changes, but by and large, when you walk into a historic district, you get the sense that you are walking into something distinctive. And we also list archaeological sites on the National Register. National Register, it's largely an honorific program. It's not regulatory in most cases. It's regulatory in the sense that if a property that's municipally owned is listed in the National Register, that municipality has to work with our office before changes can be made to that property. Private properties don't have to do that. It's only in the case of municipally owned post offices, schools, libraries, city halls, things like that. A lot of property owners are proud of the fact that their property is listed in the National Register. Most people don't take out big billboards stating that they're listed in the National Register, but it's used as a promotional tool because it is something that's been recognized as being distinctive. Bed and breakfasts love to advertise that they're listed in the National Register. Wisconsin's one of the few states in the country that has economic incentives for private property owners to restore their buildings. Now, this program's not mandatory. They don't have to do this. But it's a program that's available if they so choose to take advantage of it. Now, Bob's going to talk about some findings that him and Jennifer found properties that were eligible for listing in the National Register. There's a handful of buildings that are individually eligible for listing in the National Register. The private homes that are individually eligible, they qualify for the tax credit program right now. In a nutshell, what the program is, you have to spend a minimum of $10,000 on a project. You have to get your work approved by my office before you start it. That's huge. It's not retroactive. The work has to be approved by my office. It has to be for eligible work, which is like putting a new roof on a building, updating the mechanicals, pointing, things like that. If you follow the procedures, you can deduct 25% of those costs off of your state income taxes owed. It's not off of property taxes. It's not a grant program. It's a credit off of your state income taxes. And the website's up there. It's wisconsinhistory.org. This is an example of a property that was listed in the National Register over in Kewaunee County. And I mentioned how it has, I mentioned a property has to have historic integrity to be listed in the National Register. The Halida farm here reeks of historic integrity. It was built around 1870. There's about a dozen outbuildings all around it. This building, when the current owners bought it, did not have electricity, did not have indoor plumbing, did not have insulation. It was just like it was back in 1870. That's a little too much historic integrity. They were able to use the tax credits, though, to put a new roof on it, to repair the windows, and I stress the word repair the historic windows. This is not a program that will allow you to do whatever you want to your old building. It's a preservation program, so the work that's done has to be done in the spirit of preserving the character of the building. And windows are a huge character-defining component of a building. So if you're going to, if you say, oh, a window salesman told me I got to replace all 35 windows in my house, don't be surprised if your project gets turned down. That's not going to be approved, probably. But if you're going to repair them, you're going to tuck point the building, update the mechanicals, this program is available for you if you want to take advantage of it. There's a similar program for commercial buildings, retail buildings, apartment buildings, duplexes. These all fall in the realm of income-producing properties, and there's a federal tax credit program that's available. And again, information can be found on our website detailing the program. So that's all that I had. I will I'd be happy to answer questions you have now, or maybe after Bob talks, I'd be happy to answer questions that folks might have. But I want to thank you again for allowing us the time to speak here, and thank you for your interest in the program.
Any questions right now before we move on?
Audience? Residents?
Any questions from our visitors before we move on? You'll get another chance later on as well.
Hello, my name is Bob Short with Legacy Architecture, and I was one of the two principal investigators completing the intensive survey, the other being Jennifer Lurkey, who I believe you've all met before. I think that Joe did a pretty good job explaining the purpose of the survey, to identify buildings that are eligible for listing in the National Register. So I'll explain how we conducted the survey. There's four major phases, the first being what's called a reconnaissance survey, and that is also called a windshield survey, where we basically drive up and down every street in the community and look at every building, and note which maintain their historic integrity. And we take notes about the style of the building, the location we mark on map, etc. And all of that information is then put onto the Wisconsin Historical Society's architectural and historic inventory on their website, also called the AHI. And that is available to the public to search and to find out information about any documented historic building in the state. Then the second phase of the survey would be architectural and historical research, finding out more about these buildings. We did the majority of our research with the help of some volunteers from the Historic Alloy Society at the Brown County Library and the Wisconsin Historical Society, and through the collections of the Historic Alloy Society and its members. The third phase would be evaluation of the significance of the resources. After we identify the properties, we as the consultant make a list and of every property that we think might possibly have a chance at being eligible, far above the number that are actually eligible. And we drive the State Historic Preservation Officer around your community, and so they are the authority that determines whether or not something is eligible. So they viewed all of the properties that I will be showing this presentation, among many, many others. And then, of course, the preparation of the report and this presentation tonight. I think Joe did a pretty good job of what is significant and the different criteria that they fall under. We organized the intensive survey report into different chapters or study units that are set out by the National Park Service. They are listed. It's pretty comprehensive. So to tell you what we found, we identified 785 properties that maintain their historic integrity in the village, of which 13 were determined to be individually eligible for listing in the National Register of Historic Places. We also identified 3 historic districts that are also eligible for listing in the National Register. And I will explain those buildings and the most prevalent architectural styles that we found in the village and the districts next. The oldest style that we found was the Gothic Revival style. We found 3 examples in the survey. I believe they were all located in the cemeteries. The Gothic Revival style is popular in Wisconsin between 1850 and 1880. It is rather picturesque style with steeply sloped roofs, ornate chimneys and towers that project above the roof line. The characteristic buttresses and battlements of Gothic architecture. Of course, also pointed arched windows. The popular Queen Anne style, we surveyed 2 examples. It was popular during the 1880s to 1910, as Joe said. It has many characteristic elements that you might be familiar with, like bay windows, towers, turrets, tall chimneys, wraparound porches, especially lavish surface decoration. Neoclassical revival style was also a very popular style, especially for mausoleums in the cemeteries. This is the Bishop Joseph John Fox Mausoleum in the Alloy Catholic Cemetery, which is individually eligible for listing for as a significant example of the neoclassical revival style. It was constructed around 1915, so sort of in the middle of its period of popularity. The popularity of the style was a large result of the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago, which all the buildings were designed in neoclassical styles. It's a style that's heavily symmetrical with a lot of classical detailing like pediments, pilasters, and columns. This house on Miramar Drive is an example of the American four-square style, which we surveyed 9 examples of. It was popular during the first couple decades of the 20th century. It's characterized by its square plan and boxy massing. It always features a low-pitched hip roof. It often has a central dormer. It may have a full porch or just a small stoop such as this one. This is an example of the bungalow style, built in 1936, sort of at the end of the style's popularity. The porch is a prominent feature of the bungalow style. This one has some classical influences. They commonly have craftsman influence. the old Alloway Water Department building on Webster Avenue that was built in 1947 is individually eligible as a significant example of the Colonial Revival style. This was a prevalent and very popular style in Wisconsin during the first half of the 20th century. As you can see, we surveyed around 150 examples of this style in the village. So this building is eligible as one of the most significant examples of the style locally. It can have gable roofs, dormers, simple columns and pilasters, denticulated cornices and shutters. This is a really great example of use of stone. A more formal version of the Colonial Revival is the Georgian Revival. We found six examples in the survey, and they were almost all rather significant examples in the style. It's one of the unique characteristics of Alloway is that there were so many examples. This is the first of, I think, four that are individually eligible as examples of this style. They are often characterized by having a large or a two-story portico with columns along the front of the building, plating windows, pediments, and classical columns. So this was the George A. Richardson House built in 1924. The Roger Minahan House on Langley Road built in 1938 is also individually eligible as an example of this style. As is the Albert Newfield House on Whitney Street built in 1940. And the Bernard and Florence Darling House on Green Avenue that was built in 1943. And it's important to note that this house is eligible as an example of the Georgian Revival style and not for its association with Bernard, who was a Packers player. The Frederick G. High House on Beaupré Street was built in 1947, and it is an example of the Regency style, which is a simplified version of the Colonial Revival style. It's a lot more rare than the other forms of the style. This was the only example we found in the village. It is a lot more simplified, and it often features coins or the decorative stonework that you see on the sides of the doors here. They're commonly and most often on the corners of the building. There's usually a very plain roof-wall juncture, and styles based on the classical proportions rather than decorative embellishments. That's why it's so simple.
If that building is lime green now, does it like lose any of its historic?
Well, this is a building that we included in the survey, but was not eligible for listing. Usually, painted masonry is the kind of the same as the artificial siding.
Okay, so that's what made this one from eligible to surveyed.
No, this house just lacks significance. It is the only example of the style, but it's a very small, diminutive example. These examples of this style can be rather large. So this just isn't as significant of an example as others in the area or the state.
Okay.
The Dutch Colonial Revival style is a lot less formal than the other Colonial Revival styles. It was also part of the period revival era of the early 20th century. We found 14 examples that we included in the survey. It's characterized by its gambrel roof, or the roof with the two different pitches. This house at 226 Miramar Drive was built in 1927 and was later the house of Don Hudson of the Packers, and it is individually eligible as an example, as a significant example of the Tudor Revival style. It was also one of the more prolific styles in the village. We surveyed 89 examples. It's got an irregular plan, steeply pitched gabled roofs. The sort of hallmark of the style is the decorative half timbering that is often on the second floor and infilled with stucco in this example. There's often tall, narrow, multi-paned windows, bays, chimneys with decorative chimney pots. Another style that we found several significant examples of in Alloway is the Mediterranean Revival style. It's a little more rare in Wisconsin than the other period revival styles, and we surveyed 7 examples. This is the Frank Murphy House. It was constructed in 1920. It's now on Braeburn Court. It is characterized by arched openings and columns, stone balconies and porch railings. There's often terracotta and plaster and tile ornamentation. There's usually a red clay tile roof such as this. The Herman and Lillian Greeling House on Webster Avenue, built in 1920, is also individually eligible as an example of the Mediterranean Revival style. And the Alloway Waterworks on Green Avenue, built in 1925, is also individually eligible as an example of this style in a non-residential use. Similar to the Mediterranean Revival is the Spanish Colonial Revival style. This house was built in 1941, so at the end of the style of popularity. It's a rather unique house with the central turret at the entrance. This style often features mission-style elements like wooden vigas and iron grill work. It often has stucco walls and red clay tile roofs as well. A more modern and less formal style of the Spanish Colonial Revival is the Monterey, which is characterized by a usually full-length porch on the second story with iron railings and columns. I think this is going to be the last period revival style, is the French Provincial. This is the Cobb House on Brevoort Lane, built in 1953. It is characterized by the steeply pitched roofs and the windows that usually rise above the cornice line of the roof at the eaves, and commonly rectangular doors and arched openings. Here's a nice house. This is the Alroy Van Oss House on Sunset Circle. It was built in 1955. It is a pretty good example of the ranch style, which is the most prolific style found in Alloway. We surveyed over 200 examples of this style, and as the style is so prevalent, our sort of bar for what we included in the survey had to be raised. For all the more mid-century and contemporary housing styles, just because that was when Alloway experienced its largest building boom. So this is obviously characterized by being a single story with a couple different plan configurations. They usually have attached garages, sliding glass doors, large picture windows. They may have detailing from Colonial Revival styles, such as decorative shutters or wooden or iron porch supports. This is an example of the split-level style. We included 36 examples of this style in the survey. It was popular during the mid-20th century. It's basically a multi-story version of the ranch. After sort of the rise of popularity in modern styles, traditional styles became popular again in residential design in sort of the neo-eclectic revival era. And the first example of that I'm going to be talking about is the neo-colonial, which was very popular in Alloway. We included 70 examples of it in the survey. It was popular from the 50s through today. So this is the Fuller House, built in 1969. That house wasn't 50 years old, but we look at buildings that are approaching 50 years of old, just so that the survey isn't outdated in, you know, 10 years. This is an example of the neoclassical style. It's a little more rare. We found 9 good examples to include in the survey. The neo-eclectic styles are generally less historically accurate interpretations of traditional styles, whereas the period revival styles were more accurate reinterpretations of traditional or older styles. This is an example of the Neo-Mediterranean style. We included 4 examples. This is an example of the Mansard style, popular during the 1960s to early 1980s. And this house on Terreview Drive is an example of the Neo-French style. The National Park Service is in the process of coming up with names and the best ways to describe contemporary and modern styles. So currently, it just labels everything contemporary. And this is the Jerome Gallagher House on Roselawn Boulevard. It was constructed in 1960 and is individually eligible as a significant example of contemporary style architecture. We did include one structure that is individually eligible in the survey, and that would be the Chicago Northwestern Railroad Bridge, built in 1897 over the Fox River. It is individually eligible as a significant local example of the swing bridge type of structure. It was popular during the 1890s to 1930, but especially before 1910, and it was used often for all types of vehicle bridges, and generally those just for motor vehicles have been replaced by other types of bridges. So this is a pretty rare example, and even on the day we took this picture, it was in operation, as I'm sure many of you have seen. We identified, and the Wisconsin Historical Society determined, 3 residential historic districts in the village of Alloway. The first being the Miramar Drive Historic District. It consists of 26 buildings, out of which 23 contribute to the district and 3 are non-contributing. The boundaries of the district, of all districts, are always drawn to exclude as many buildings that do not fit the character of the district, and so this district is pretty tight with just 3 buildings that don't contribute. So there would be 3 buildings that are of later vintage or that have a much more extreme lack of integrity. In the historic districts, the integrity issues can be looked at less as districts are more about the whole rather than the significance of each individual example. So this district is a significant example of residential architectural styles from 1924 to 1950, most prominently Colonial Revival and Tudor Revival. The largest district we found, we are calling the Robinson Hill Residential Historic District. It consists of 84 buildings, 10 of which are non-contributing. It is all single and multifamily residences and is significant during the period of 1910 to 1942, particularly for Tudor Revival, Colonial Revival, and bungalow-style architecture. And the third district that we identified is the Sunset Circle Residential Historic District. It consists of 16 buildings, which all contribute to the district, and it is a significant example of single-family residential architecture from 1938 through one house built in 1987 that the state decided would be contributing to the district despite its age. And it's primarily ranch and neo-colonial and other neo-eclectic style buildings. And it just so happens that in this district is the Vincent and Marie Lombardi House, which contributes to the district, but as well is individually eligible under the criteria for its association with Vince Lombardi and his significance to the professional sport of football. So its period of significance is its construction date of 1959 through 1969, at which time Vince retired as the Packers head coach. The last part of our report is a list of recommendations for the village and its preservation commission on how to proceed with the results of this survey and in their work of preserving the history of Alloway. And so we recommend continuing to hold regular commission meetings. The commission should maintain its CLG certified local government status. Because it's a certified local because the village is a CLG, you were able to obtain the grant funding that funded this survey. And so we definitely recommend that you continue to apply for future CLG funds to possibly list some of these individual and district properties in the National Register. We encourage the commission to monitor threats to historic resources and to definitely continue their public education initiatives and public education of the history of the village as well. Are there any questions?
The Sunset Circle, this is just the properties, right? It's not any adjoining public land, parks, just the properties,
The park was not included.
Okay.
Because it's not an example of residential architecture from that period of time.
And this includes just the property, or what?
It's the property boundaries, the legal parcel that the house is on for each one of those, and that the boundaries encompass all of those parcels.
But you also said it's just sort of I forgot what to call it, recommending and not regulatory designation, so...
Correct. If Sunset Circle was listed in the National Register of Historic Places, it wouldn't be regulated. People could do what they wanted with their buildings. There are tax credits available if they wish to pursue that, but at the end of the day, it's their property. They can do what they want as far as the National Register is concerned.
So if there's designation as a National Historic Place of Significance, and a month later they swap out all the windows, mm-hmm. and what happens? Do they get taken off of the registry then, or how does that work?
That's a good question. If it's an individually listed property, one building, if those changes happen to it, the worst that could happen is it gets taken off the register. Tonight you're looking at one-third of the National Register staff, so for the state of Wisconsin, I don't have time to drive around looking to see which buildings are still having to. But if it's brought to our attention, we would delist it. Now, in the case of a historic district, you can see that there's 16 buildings. So if one property owner decided to tear his building down, that's not a problem. If you get four or five that start to really muck up their buildings, then we might delist it. But again, we don't actively do that.
Yeah.
Don't have time for it.
Once they're listed or once the survey is done, is there any undoing it?
Well, that's one thing I wanted to make sure that I came up to talk about. Bob mentioned that the properties that they surveyed, they entered them into our database, the Architecture History Inventory. It's on our website. And any of the information that's on there, it's available to the public. But if you look at the bottom of each record, my email address is there. So if you know of something where the information is incorrect, or if you have additional information to add to it, send it to me and I'll update the record. Don't send it to Bob or Jennifer, because after tonight, this project's done for them, but the results come to my office and we administer. And so if you have changes to any of the records, send those to me. As far as updating surveys, we tend to try to update them about every 15 years, where we go back and wholeheartedly look at everything all over again to update it. But other than that, that's the process for changing the survey. The other thing that I had, I didn't want to forget it, I brought some pamphlets that my office has a conference each fall for local historical societies and commission members. This year it's being held in Wisconsin Rapids, and it has a whole variety of topics that would be of interest. One is how to preserve modern buildings. You know, Bob mentioned you have a lot of mid-20th century buildings here. It would be good for the commission or the historical society to get a handle on how to interpret those types of resources. Also, there's very nuts and bolts types of workshops. There's one on how to preserve historic bricks. You know, it's how to tuck point bricks properly, and we have a whole number of sessions such as that. So, registration's on our website, but also I brought some pamphlets along here. So I just wanted to make sure I didn't forget that.
Okay. I think also to answer your question, it's important to remember that this document, this report, isn't a regulation and it's not a designation. It's just an inventory of the historic building stock in the village. It's a snapshot in time that says, in 2013, these are the historic buildings that existed and maintained their historic integrity. So it's a living document that's bound to change as more buildings become of age to be considered historic and, you know, changes happen to buildings. Buildings might be restored and they might retain their historic integrity where they didn't previously.
Were there other areas? You picked three districts, and it's my understanding that, you know, as a village, we would get three districts. What? How about Camp Smith?
None of these items are listed. The process of nominating them to be listed has to happen before they're in the National Register. This is just stating these are the ones that would be eligible.
Correct. I understand that. But what is considered the Camp Smith area, had that been looked at, or how did it not?
Well, there's no historic resources above ground that remain associated with Camp Smith, aside from the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which we included in the survey, but is not eligible for listing. If that question is about Heritage Hill as a larger part, we discuss the eligibility of Heritage Hill in the education chapter of the report, and I would suggest you look at it. Several of the buildings, maybe six or seven, in Heritage Hill are listed on the National Register. There are a couple buildings in Heritage Hill that were delisted when they were moved, as integrity of location is another factor that factors into integrity. So the Fort Howard buildings, the original ones, not the replicas at Heritage Hill, those are listed in the National Register as their significance outweighs the fact that they were moved. Does that answer your question?
I think so. Can we hear from the Historical Society? And
I wanted to make sure there weren't any other questions here first. Joe, can you tell me the process? So these are the recommendations, and then the board is being asked to approve the study, and I'm assuming the recommendations included. What would be the next step if we did that this evening?
Well, the next step is the report comes to my office, and it's used for us to review inquiries that come into our office. Like if somebody wants to do a tax credit project on a property in Alloway, we'll take a look at the report and see what it has to say about it. The next step for the village is to follow through on these recommendations. I was talking to Tracy earlier about going forward with other grant applications. The criteria is the same. The money comes from my office. The village would pay the bills but then get reimbursed 100% by my office to do the work. So the next step would be to see if there's interest in these historic districts to try and list them in the National Register. And if so, Tracy could draft up an application and I would have a very good chance of funding. So that's kind of the next step for the commission, is to use this report and go forward with it.
So we would actually complete the paperwork to apply for registry.
Correct.
Using the recommendations in this report.
Correct. You could use grant monies to hire people to do the National Register nominations.
Okay, got it. And is there a state registry?
Yes, there is a state registry. It's this. It's a parallel program with the National Register. It's just administered by my office. Okay. So the criteria are exactly the same. It's just that we're the final say on the state register, whereas the National Register, the National Park Service at the federal level is the final say.
But all the criteria and the process are even the same.
Correct.
It's just that whether
the same
or not,
process.
Who
yes.
does the evaluation and okay.
So
and
who has the final say on it?
Got it.
Yep. Yep.
Thank you. Trustee Genrich.
There's nothing limiting about this kind of a thing. Let's say something gets discovered down the road.
Trustee Genrich, please.
There's nothing limiting about this proposal, is there?
No, not all. Like Bob was mentioning, this is a living document. Right. So, you know, if somebody goes home tonight and finds more information, you email that to me. It's, we can't update the report because that's kind of a standalone item. But the individual research that goes into each building that frequently gets changed, and those changes get sent to me. Like Trustee Green was mentioning beforehand, she knows of a property owner where they restored their building since the survey was done. The process would be send me a photograph, and we can add it to the survey and add information to it. So.
Yeah, and you also said you're available for questions. So
yes,
speaking of which, Joe was nice enough to give his phone number and card, so we may want to actually put it on our website with the report, because I know we've got some property owners that are working hard as they work on their homes to maintain or restore the integrity of those homes, and they may be looking for advice.
Yeah, Trustee Green was mentioning that I've been working in this field for over 25 years. I don't have all the answers. I don't expect you to be able to interpret the National Register to your constituents. So
that's why we send them to you.
Yeah, please send them to me, and I'd be happy to talk with them. So
there's a separate process, and we would fill out the application for the National Register, and. What would they would go on the information included in the survey? Is that what they would?
What
if we submitted an application for an individual property that wasn't included in the survey as being eligible? What do they use to decide what's?
That's a good question. They like let's say we have an individual property. Bob mentioned that there's 13 individually eligible properties that the survey identified. Trustee Gingrich has a property. It's not one of those 13, but he's interested in finding out if his house qualifies. On our website, there's a form called the National Register Questionnaire. It's a very short form. It's tell us what you know about the property. Include current photos, one of each side of the house. Tell us what you know about the property and send it to me. We'll take a look at the survey and see what the survey said. The big thing is one thing that may have neglected. All these photos that are on here, those will all be part of our website. So Bob mentioned that this survey is a snapshot in time. We can see what the house looked like in 2013. And if it turns out that you've done work to the building to unveil its historic character that wasn't visible in 2013, then we can reevaluate it. Or you might get a letter saying, well, it looks just like it did in 2013. We have nothing new to change the not eligible, so we're going to stay with that. The biggest thing is the historical significance. That's not visible in a photograph. So if you come up with historical information, that's the key to send to us. It still has to have integrity, things like that, but history is huge. And to expect Bob and Jennifer to have looked at every historical resource document out there, it's unrealistic. So there's always going to be new information. So if you have historical information, by all means, pass that on. The worst that can happen is we say no, it's not eligible.
I'm still a little bit confused. Let's say Trustee Genrich decides next year that I think I got something here. He goes to your website, he fills out the questionnaire. Is that for the state or is that for the National Register?
It's for both. It's just a preliminary document. It allows us to go, hey, let's take a look and see if there's something here. The National Register nomination, I liken it to doing your taxes. It's a federal document. In theory, anybody can do their taxes. I used to do my own taxes. Well, now I'm divorced, but I don't think it was from filling out my taxes. My ex-wife and I, we would battle all weekend trying to fill out our tax return. By the end of the weekend, we had it done, but we were at wit's end. These are the same folks that produced the National Register nomination. In theory, anybody can fill it out, but it's best to hire somebody to do it that's familiar with it. Well, before you go to the expense of hiring somebody to prepare a National Register nomination, this questionnaire is something where we can very quickly go, yeah, you might want to pursue it, or no, don't even.
Okay, so the questionnaire is for your office as sort of a first step or a filter as to whether you
think. Exactly. The questionnaire does not list the property, but it allows the property owner to know that they might be onto something, or it doesn't stand a snowball's chance.
Okay, and then if Trustee Gendry's decided, you tell him, yeah, you think you might have something, he goes ahead and either hires someone to do the research for him, or he fills out the tax form himself.
Right.
And that goes directly to the feds, and they evaluate based on what he submitted, not on anything from the state that...
Well, it comes into our office. We're the voice of the National Register in Wisconsin.
Okay.
We will pass it on to the National Park Service when that time comes, but it comes to us for review. That's like all these recommendations that were made here was done by our staff. We're the National Register staff in Wisconsin here. And so if there's concerns about what's eligible and what's not eligible, we're the ones you got to come to. I mean, Bob and Jennifer, they looked at everything. They cast a very wide net, and then they show those resources to our staff, and we're the ones that cut it down.
So it's not a completely independent process, and that in both cases, whether someone's applying for the state or the National Register, the application goes to the state, and there's a filtering process.
Correct.
I mean, even after that first small questionnaire, there's a filtering process, and then you make the recommendation. You either send it on to the feds or you don't. Is it you sort of have veto power?
When it comes to us, at the questionnaire level, that's where we say yes or no. And if we say it's yes, we'll pass it on through the process. I can't say the feds will rubber stamp what we say because in my 25 years, they turned us differed with our opinion, I think, twice out of the thousands of nominations. So in theory, it can happen, but. It typically, if we think something is eligible for the National Register, the National Park Service will
take your lead on it.
Right.
And so basically, they're probably going to take the lead on this survey because this survey was commissioned through you and vetted through you.
Correct. Our staff is trained by the National Park Service according to their standards on how they want surveys done and how the National Register is done.
They've all been doing it for over 20 years.
Our staff, in turn, has two consultant training workshops each year where we train the consultants on what the National Park Service wants. So it's a process where we have a highly skilled staff, but then we also have highly skilled consultants doing the work.
I'm not questioning any of the expertise of anyone involved. I'm just trying to understand the process. So if someone comes forward and wants to do this, they should know. You're going to have a pre-questionnaire that's pretty simple. You're going to get maybe you should explore it or not from the state. If you do, it's on your dime to hire someone to do the work yourself. And then it's still going to go back to the state, who is representing the feds.
Yep.
They're going to do the evaluation. And then if they say yes and send it on to the feds, chances are the feds are going to accept it. Do I have it right?
Yep.
Okay, good.
Are state and federal guidelines the same?
National Park Service standards. And just for an example, the same staff at the Wisconsin Historical Society that administer the National Park Service programs in Wisconsin are the same people that receive the questionnaires about nomination eligibility, and they're the same people who reviewed in the field our findings for the survey. And the survey can be a good indication to a large degree of what is eligible. For example, you mentioned that there's three historic districts that were identified as eligible. We probably showed the Wisconsin Historical Society staff probably 10 or 12 areas that we thought might be districts, and the other 9 were declined. Or in the instance of the Miramar Drive district, the boundaries that they approved were much smaller than what we thought they were going to be. Just to give
us. Well, it could be a fly on the wall. They have to be, I mean, a lot of this is a little bit subjective as to whether
the
integrity thing. And
So
you must have plenty of discussions amongst the three of you or amongst the rep from your office and the consultants who actually did the survey as to what's eligible or not? Or do you just
it's
cast a really wide net and then they decide?
We cast a huge net, okay. And it's the State Historic Preservation Officer who...
Right, yeah. And, you know, it is subjective, but, you know, our staff is a little long of tooth. I think our most recent number is about 12 years in Wisconsin and then previous with other states. And what we try to do is be consistent. Now,
right.
People may not agree with our findings, but we try to be consistent through it. There's no benefit for us in turning things down for the National Register.
Right.
So, but we have, we're held up by the National Park Service as one of the top programs in the country.
Right.
For what we do.
Why doesn't someone get state on the state registry if they get, because the process is the same, and if they're for all practical purposes, the Park Service's rubber stamp is 99.9 times out of 100 taking your recommendation. Why, if someone applies for the National Registry and it goes through the state anyway, why don't they automatically get on the state registry?
They do.
Oh, they
do. Sorry about that. I overlooked
right.
The obvious there, yes. It comes through the same process, and when it's approved by us, it's put on the state register.
Got it.
And then it continues on its way to the National Park Service for listing in the National Register.
And can someone apply for their state register, but say, I don't want it to go to the National Register?
They can.
They would.
There's really no
okay.
need to. There's been, I think, 2 instances of that. Both of them were because one of the former governors had a provision in his budget that allowed a state register property to get a tax-exempt status. That was both instances, so it typically does not happen.
Thanks, I've learned quite a bit. Trustee Green.
And then just one more question. The properties that were individually eligible versus properties that are surveyed. So the individually eligible ones are the ones that you know?
Correct. The ones that were identified, the 13 that were identified as being individually eligible for listing, right now meet the criteria for designation and listing in the National Register. They're not listed,
right?
But they meet the criteria.
What do
you
the
also
people
don't
who are
have to go through the questionnaire process because it's been...
Ah, okay. Now, the surveyed, the ones that were designated as surveyed, those would need to go through the questionnaire process.
Right.
And, okay, got it.
Yeah, and, you know, as far as the survey results, if a property was identified as being surveyed, mm-hmm. not individually eligible... You know, we're looking at this property, and we're in agreement that it's not eligible for its architectural significance because we can see it.
Yeah.
Now, if there was some historical angle that might make it significant, that should be brought to our attention. But if you're coming to us and saying, hey, I own this property, it was surveyed, it looks just like it did in 2013, we're going to say it's... You know, it was not eligible then. It's nothing's changed as far as we can see. It's going to still be not eligible.
There are also several properties that I didn't mention in the presentation. There are several properties that I didn't mention in the presentation that we recommend be looked at when the area of significance of historical significance becomes 50-year-old. It's a couple houses that are associated with prominent businessmen whose significance hasn't ended yet. They're still professionals or they're still working.
You mentioned there were 5 or 6 of the Georgian-style houses in Alloy. Were they all surveyed or were they...
We included 6 examples. There might have been others that didn't have integrity that we didn't include in the survey, but we included 6 examples of the style, and of those 6, 4 were determined to be eligible by the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Wow.
So that is a learning.
So it's pretty unique for this area, then. I mean, aren't you compared to your peers in the area?
Well, one thing that I noticed here that's both a pro and a con, if you will, is the houses are so well maintained in Alloway that the survey bar is set pretty high. You have really good examples of all these styles. So you're taking the best of the best when you're saying something's eligible, and that is very distinctive. I've been to communities where pretty much everything's artificially sited, and there's nothing here. They surveyed almost 800 buildings. That's an incredible number of buildings that have enough integrity to be looked at, and that's outside of Milwaukee, Madison, and La Crosse. You just don't have surveys that are coming up with that many buildings. And so it is, that's both, like I said, it's a good thing showing how well maintained the buildings are. It's a bad thing because it makes it hard to say which one's better than the rest. They're all really quite good.
But you're compared to other properties, not just in Alloway, right? In the Green Bay area, or?
No, the survey looks at just the village limits. It looks at how does this resource stack up against its peers in the community. It's unfair to say how does this building stack up to something in Milwaukee, in suburban Milwaukee. So we don't. I neglected to talk about the National Register has three levels of designation. Something can be locally significant, statewide significant, or nationally significant. And most properties are locally important. That's how this survey, it looked at the local level. How do these buildings stack up against their peers?
Everything that was determined to be individually eligible in this survey was individually eligible at the local level, or significant at the local level, with the exception of the Lombardi House, which the Wisconsin Historical Society believes is eligible at the national level of significance and may also be eligible for designation as a national historical landmark.
What that means is it's compared to similar properties at the national level. That's extremely rare. Typically, we don't look at things beyond the community's limits.
Then there was an example of it was a small house that Trustee Dartzer had painted lime green since. But that was the only example of that in all of Alloway. And you said, well, one of the reasons it wasn't chosen is because it's not big enough. But it's the only one in Alloway, so relative to its peers, it's really good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's first.
Yeah, it's the only. It's the only. But as far as the National Register is concerned, even at the survey level, it has to, it has to have the characteristics of the style to be significant. So while this may be the only one of the style, that's why it was surveyed, because it stands out. It doesn't have all of the bells and whistles of the Regency style, so it's not significant, and that's the key. It's an example, not a significant.
I thought it was a good example. It just wasn't as large as. Okay. Got it.
One last question about the Sunset Park, because later on tonight we're going to be discussing Sunset Park and some changes. And I think you addressed this, but this will have no effect on any plans we have for that park. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. I'd like to hear from our visitors, unless there are other questions or comments from the board. We have folks here from the Historic Society or the committee, Historical Preservation Committee.
Hi, I'm Bobby Fredericks. I'm from the Historical Preservation Committee. I wrote the grant to get this project, and 2 weeks ago we had the presentation that you've seen this evening, and our group did approve the report as it stands. We hope that you would approve it too, so we can use this as a baseline going forward.
Thank you. Anybody else from that committee, or anybody else overall, would like to weigh in? I feel like I should pay some tuition. I learned a lot about the whole process. It was great. I'll have to fight the construction in Madison now to learn.
That's all online.
Anybody else? Okay, we'll take up the rules. Any further discussion amongst the board? Okay, I will entertain a motion since it's part of this agenda for approval. Trustee Green.
Move to approve.
Is there a second? Trustee Kopisch?
Second.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. I thought we'd put in a request that you bring another big check when you come back. Every time you come back. No?
Next time you have a grant, I'll bring one.
Okay, all right. Fair enough. Public appearances. Is there anyone who'd like to speak this evening? Hearing none, we will move on to item 6, action regarding the escort service ordinance, and this was postponed from our last meeting. I think I'll open it up to DEO Lott now first. What's your objection? Is there a summary you want to give? It looked pretty straightforward to me. You highlighted it in certain areas. That
yeah, I was going to mention, I looked at Green Bay's ordinance, and all the local ordinances are pretty much based off of Green Bay, so there's very little difference. The highlighted areas are just a definition that I changed. That was the only major change I made, other than the alleyway where I think I got the copy of it from Bellevue, where it was. So their ordinance referred to a definition that was somewhere else in their village code, so I just included that definition. The definitions within the ordinance, and that was literally the only change I made. Otherwise, it's pretty straightforward.
I specific anatomical areas is the part that you've highlighted, and it's in the definitional area. Where does it show up later?
Second page under subsection G in part 3, regulated acts. In the original version of it that the other communities had, it refers to the definition in a different section of their code, so I just changed it to show the definition within the code.
Any other questions before we entertain a motion? Okay, take up the rules again. Is there a motion with regard to this item?
Question first.
Yes.
Tracy had talked to Attorney Duffy on this, and maybe we should hear that before we go further.
Yeah.
You know what? I'll entertain a motion first, and then we'll cover it under discussion. Is there a motion with regard to this item?
Moved it.
Is there a motion with regard? Trustee Gedrich, is there a second?
I'll second.
Trustee Kopisch seconds. Discussion? Tracy.
Just some discussions with Attorney Duffy. This is not in the final ordinance form. This is just kind of taking Green Bay, so I would have to put the final ordinance form. And I'd like to have Dennis take a look at it, too, or if he would like to, and just review it as well and make sure he doesn't have any issues with it. The other thing I did ask him, this came up at our last meeting, was if you can prohibit escort services in the community, just say, you just can't have it or you can't do it. He said you cannot outright prohibit it. It's kind of like when offenders get out of jail and you can't totally prohibit them from living in your community, it's that same kind of criteria you have to meet. So the ordinance cannot totally prohibit them. It can make it difficult. It can make them have different criteria they have to meet and all of that, but they cannot prohibit them. So that would be my recommendation, if we go ahead with it, to have our attorney look at it and see if he has any concerns with it.
Debbie actually leaned over just a minute ago and said that same thing. What we're going to be approving is to send this forward to the attorney to put in the ordinance form, and then it would come back to this board. Is that
Correct.
Your understanding?
Yeah, just a point of clarification. It certainly isn't intended as an endorsement, but certainly after having talked with other other community officials in other communities, talking about the importance of the regulation, you know, particularly in any communities that have hotels, entertainment, hospitality type district or facilities.
Right. If you had a chance to look through the whole thing, you can see the requirements are quite stringent. As far as background checks, money up front, all that kind of stuff. So we're definitely not encouraging the activity, but right now there's nothing on it, so there's no way to regulate it if the situation does come up. So it's just something to have on paper. So if it does come up, we can take enforcement action on it.
And that's what I was wondering about, the physical contact and why it's even needed, and now I sort of get it. I mean, we can't prohibit the business, but we can prevent particular activities within the business. Trustee Green.
Actually, we have had one issue with this in years past going on within the village. The individual just happened to get arrested in a Schwabenon before it reached the problems here. So, and it was this particular ordinance in a Schwabenon that this individual was stopped. So.
Trustee Dorn.
Under exceptions, I was just kind of silly, but under for escort, my husband used to work in social work, and he took cognitively disabled people to Six Flags, but that wouldn't count, right? That would be under the exceptions.
I guess that's something you can talk to Attorney Duffy about. I'm thinking that's not the intent or purpose of
the
ordinance.
Right, it was not the intent, but.
Right, I guess we can double check on that.
Yeah, sure I think the exclusions really does cover that.
I would hope so, because I can think of other scenarios like that.
Sure.
Involving healthcare situations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The way I read exemptions to it is, I think it would be included under there.
Because
an incidental part of your husband's.
Yeah,
work,
they didn't
right?
go to Six Flags every day.
They didn't go to Six Flags
but
every day.
But he did escort them to many places.
Okay.
You know what I mean? That was a primary function, was escorting people to the doctor, to this, to that. To
but as part of a licensed
yes,
agency, and he refers to that in here, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We could also, you know, maybe include a specific line referring to health care.
Mm-hmm.
The exemptions, I don't know, something like this. Dr. Duffy, you're curious about?
I was going to say, it's a good question, because I know several things have had unintended consequences. We didn't, yeah.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to move this forward into ordinance form and to have it looked at by Attorney Duffy. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Item 7, action regarding the award of the bid for Sunset Park Trail Project. Is there a motion with regard to this item? Or do you want to hear from Mr. Lang first? Trustee Gendrich?
I'll move.
Move ahead with the recommended bid for the
yes.
trail project. Okay. Is there a second? Trustee Dart, seconds. Discussion. Mr. Lang.
Within the motion, if you would please add the verbiage, the award, that the award is contingent upon the Wisconsin DNR and Brown County easement approval.
I would do
is
that
understood, Trustee
yes.
Hendricks? And it is stated in the recommendation in the memo, Trustee Dart?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else?
The bids came in really well. Extremely less than what we anticipated. I think we're about 50% of what we anticipated at this point.
Wow.
Nice. So the project will continue and will then give us the opportunity to do the landscaping that we were hoping to do.
Do you foresee any of that happening before fall? Or will that be a next spring installation? Never mind.
We're we're moving forward as if we were going to get it done this fall.
Okay.
We might be able to take advantage of lower prices on some of those high-priced plans that were recommended in the original plan. There was some discussion about the path and distance from properties, and we're going to explore that. That's been explored.
There were some changes made.
Some minor changes, and okay. So we've done our due diligence with regard to that issue. Good, thank you. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Action regarding purchase of the residential lot at 2524 Libel Street. I'm going to suspend the rules for a second and let Tracy give you a little background above and beyond that's in the memo.
Okay, basically, this is a property that was raised last year. We had some issues with the property, and after inspections, it was decided that it needed to be raised. The village did the raising. The village paid for the raising of the property, and it was about $8,000 total for the raising of the property. After that point, the property owner, even before that point, had not paid their taxes for several years on the property. And at some point in time, then the county tries to get the property or goes after the property or give to the property owner and say, will you pay your taxes? If they do not, then they go to the judge. And the judge does order the property to basically be turned over to the county. And that's what happened to this particular lot. It was turned over to the county. At that point, when it's turned over, the judge takes off all special assessments or any other charges on it except for the taxes due or any interest or penalty that could be put on it. So everything else is basically wiped off of the property. So the county had the property, was putting it up for sale, and was asking a certain price for the property. And at that point, Steve and I had talked about it, whether the village was interested in that property or not. And we also found out at that time that when the property is sold, we cannot go after them for our assessments because of the way the property was received by the county. So we cannot go back after the new property owner and say, there's a $10,000 assessment on this property and you're responsible for it. So after we discovered all of that and kind of went back and forth, we decided to come to the board and see if you had any interest in purchasing the property. The purchase of the property to the county would be about $7,700, which is back taxes for the property that we would have to pay the county for the property. As I said, we already have about $10,000 into the property for assessments. Some of it is for the raising, some of it is for cutting the lawn on the property for the last year. Water and sewer bills, I think, was on there, and there was one other smaller assessment that made up that $10,000. So that would be the cost the village already has. 10 potentially into it. If we go ahead and purchase it, it would be another $7,700 for the property. It is a small lot. It's located on the west side of Libel, just down the road a bit. Mm-hmm. I did talk to our assessor to see what the value of that lot would be. Right now, if you look it up on Brown County, it's valued at about $28,000 just for the land. He said he is reassessing it, and it will be $30,200 is what his new amount will be on that property. He feels that there aren't many, as you know, very many residential lots left in the village of Alloway, so he feels there is a value for this lot and feels that it would sell and that somebody would like that lot and come into the community and build a new home on it. Right now, as you know, it's just an empty lot. I talked to our building inspector to make sure that they could rebuild on that lot because that was one of the things that our assessor said, make sure that they can build because it is a narrow lot. It's 65 feet wide and approximately 159 feet deep, so it's a long, skinny lot. And a home could definitely be rebuilt on that lot. The setbacks could be met and it could be rebuilt. So that's really the background of the property. So the decision by the board is whether you want to look at purchasing it from the county again, putting another, almost $8,000 into the property, and then turn around and see if we can sell it and get that back, as well as our costs for the special assessments that we have outstanding on the property yet. It may sell, it may not. So that's kind of what we wanted to come to you, and Steve's
feel free to add anything into it that I maybe forgot.
And Tracy brought this to me, and I didn't know much about this process, and we're trying to have some conversations with the county so that if this ever happens again, and it could, we have some older properties, and there are some that people are just going to abandon instead of fixing up, that we, when they list a property like this, that they include assessments other than their own. And I know we can't officially go after a person who buys the land from the county, but we can ask the county to ask a more reasonable price for the land above and beyond what their back taxes are. And they're looking to recover their costs, and that's it. But there are more players in this game than just the county. I mean, we've put a lot of time and effort into that property, and to say that we're just going to walk away and take a $7,700 hit, probably plus, if you consider the amount of labor that we put into managing this, I just don't think it's a good idea. But I didn't know that we couldn't assess the new owner for the back taxes for the village until we explored this process, and we can't do that. So the only other option is us buying it and then try to resell it. It's a $30,000 property. If we sell it at half that price, we're still going to, you know, double our $7,700 investment. So that's when I said I think it's a good idea, and I wanted to bring it to the board since it does have definite budgetary implications. Trustee Green.
That would be my comment. There's been lots for sale in the village for 15, 20 years that haven't moved. Is one, why does our assessor feel this one would move and others haven't? And then two, if we list it for 17, maybe it would move. I mean, that would be, I mean, I don't see it moving for 30.
Right.
There's no way. So why it's assessed at 30, you know, I'm struggling with. So, okay, that helps. Did he say why he thought this lot would move?
You know, he didn't say this particular lot per se, Lynn.
Okay.
He just was like, there aren't a lot of lots in the middle
there
of the
are.
Valley. And he felt that was a benefit to having a lot and having it. And it's a nice neighborhood. It would be a starter home for somebody or a smaller home that somebody may be looking for that lot to get into a nicer neighborhood and into the Village of Alloway was his comment.
Those lots are double long.
Deep.
Long.
Very deep because I'm on the same area and my lot is very deep. They're narrow, but they're deep.
It's somewhat similar to the lot that the Habitat for Humanity House was built on over here, and that could be very desirable for somebody like that as well. You know, that I would certainly think we could recoup most of our money. Yeah.
You know, we do have one gentleman, a real estate agent, that's interested in it, and he said if he was going to bid on it once the county put it up, but then they pulled the bidding off that property. So we do have one real estate guy that's called W&I frequently to ask about it. And like I said, Habitat, I think, has looked at the lot as well.
Okay.
There is at least a little bit of interest, and I don't know what they're looking at for cost or anything, but there has been some.
Well, I think the long-term solution, again, is having conversations with the county so that there's a system in place where we don't want to be doing this on a routine basis of buying vacant properties and trying to resell them. That's not really the business that we're in as a village. But I couldn't let this one go when we're really going to be forgiving all the time and money that we put into this property. Trustee Dart.
Do we want an agent to represent that property?
We probably would, yes.
My
but
concern
even after
is
a, I'm not sure what they would, even after a 6% on a residential lot, I mean, the numbers are anywhere close to what the assessor says, and we get half of what the assessor says, we're still going to make out on this and recover some of our costs. I think it's a responsible thing to do with taxpayer money, and there is some risk involved, but the lot's going to sell eventually.
Well, there's no way to get the first $10,000 back, so we buy it for $7,000, we're going to get more than $7,000 for it. We'll never get the $10,000 otherwise. This way we have the opportunity to make
it. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, if I don't do it,
the first $10,000 is already gone.
Right.
And have we talked about what a reasonable period of time might be? And look, if, you know, Tracy indicated there might be an active buyer, you know, right now that would put up maybe, you know, a home, 70,000, 100,000, or whatever. So you're going to immediately start capturing tax revenue on something like that versus the village sitting on a property for a couple of years or 5 years or 16, as Lynn mentioned.
And we don't know that either. The buyer could try to resell the property for
speculation
for $15,000 if he or she buys it for $7,700. So we don't know what that
that's
person would do with it.
That's what we'd want to do.
And I'm with you. I don't want to see this go on for it. I think working with the county to get this changed. Now, is it just our county that operates that way, or is this coming from the state legislature? Or, I mean, where does this crazy situation arise from? Do we know?
I think the county sets their own
rules?
Process as far as they, you know, what they want to bring. And I think it's just easiest for them to say, look, this is what they owe in back taxes. So that's the. But someone can have it for if they're
okay.
Tracy, is that your?
There's a state statute. If you look at that, it's like the third, fourth paragraph down. It talks about once the county receives a judgment on the property, so the judge goes through it. It's a tax deed bid sale. The municipality cannot reapply any outstanding specials that were due on the property prior to the foreclosure per Wisconsin State Statute 75.36. So it sounds like it's something that is statewide, and the counties have to follow that. So it must
but the purchase price is set by the county. I mean, we can't apply our own back taxes to the new owner of the property, but the county could.
The county could do what
we're doing and put it on the market. It asks for $15,000 for the property,
okay,
and then do whatever they want with the money. And those are the discussions that we're having with them. Right, Tracy? There's nothing that limits them to only asking for the property what the owner. Oh, was in back taxes.
Correct. They could market it for any cost. They were, Carrie was explaining to me that, you know, some of the properties, like maybe in City Green Bay, less desirable properties, they end up selling them for $400 or $500 just to get rid of them because the county doesn't want the property. But there's nothing that says they can't go above the taxes due on it. They certainly can and ask more for it. And then you see in the middle of the page, it talks about how it's paid out according to that priority. So delinquent taxes, interest, special assessment charges, and it goes down the line. So if the cost comes in and it's high enough, it keeps going down the line and paying off those types of things.
You notice that in that criteria, it doesn't say reimburse the village.
Right.
Special assessments. Yeah, I guess it doesn't reimburse.
Because we would get a little maintenance with it, too. We'd have to cut the grass, or Mark would be calling us. So
they start out by doing a bid process, and if nobody bids on it, then they sell it for whatever they can get. Now, if somebody bid higher than the $7,000, we would get part of our special.
Right.
That's your understanding, correct?
So we're under special.
They said if somebody bought it for 15, if somebody bid 15, then we would get part of our share. The county gets theirs first.
Yes. So we're special assessments here. This isn't county special assessments. Those are ours. So we're number 3 here.
Oh, well, we're on the list.
It sounds in the first paragraph, and this way Terry explained it to me, when the judge does the order, the judgment removes all the liens on the property, including mortgage liens, taxes, specials, etc. So
we're removed.
Right.
Everything is removed from the property when somebody buys it.
From the property, but
right.
As far as what happens to the proceeds, that follows 1 through 5.
Correct.
Right.
Right.
So if the county decided we're going to list this at $15,000 and it's sold, the $7,700 would go to the county for back taxes. Then any penalties are delinquent, and then it would reach us.
Yep.
Correct.
But the property itself is free and clear of any.
Correct.
And that's why we wouldn't be able to go after the new owner if we weren't to buy it. And that's the discussion we're having with the county. Don't just ask for your own taxes back. When the property's worth 3-4 times as much as that, ask for enough so that at least some of it can make its way to the penalties and taxes that are owed to the village.
But if they put it out for bid, is that possible? Or do they set
They can set the minimum.
Well, and this might be fairly unique for them that they have mostly blighted type property, I think, that they inherit versus something that's got some perceived value.
I'm guessing.
Their experiences with more blighted type properties, I'm sure.
You're exactly right. I mean, Carrie said this is the first property in Dowie that has ever, this has ever occurred with in Alloway. So he, you know, Carrie had contacted us initially and said, does the village want to buy it? And we looked at it and we're like, well, can't use it for a park. It really isn't any utility value or anything. You know, talk to Craig about it. There wasn't, we felt there wasn't, you know, value for us to buy it for any public type use. So we got back to Carrie and just said, you know, no, there really isn't an interest from the village. And then, so he's like, okay, I'm going to put it on the bid. Well, then it's kind of after the fact, okay, well, what about all our special assessments? Then that started to get known, okay, that you won't get that. This is how much you put it out for. So it was us not understanding that process and how it actually worked.
Right.
And maybe if we would have caught it sooner and it would have been something that we were more familiar with, we would have, he could have handled it differently. He could have bid it at a larger amount and all of that. So in the future, he's willing to work with us on it. I don't think he isn't by any means. It's just it was a new thing for him in LA, and also it was a new thing for us.
Trustee Zeller.
My preference would be to let the county sell the property in REM is the method that they sell the property, and with any of the proceeds coming down the list, our track record in the real estate business is not very good in that village, and I don't think we have any business in trying to obtain and sell this property.
You realize we're not, nothing's going down this list. It's all stopping at one. That's the 7,700 of the, unless they get more than that, is going to the taxes for the county.
He'll list at a minimum bid of 7,700.
Yeah.
And then he'll solicit for a period of time up to a date specific seal bids. He'll open the seal bids, and then the county, the treasurer's office and the county's administrative committee will review the bids and will either accept or reject all the bids. So
it already happened, Debbie? Did you say it already happened?
No.
They were going to, but he pulled it.
Okay,
yeah.
We pulled it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So can he revise his minimum bid at this point?
I believe he can.
Because that would be a much cleaner way of doing it and just have minimum bid of 17.
I didn't think he could do that. Or is he not willing to do that? Because I thought that's why I got here is that. Because that's the this discussion that we're having for the long term is don't just do the
right,
minimum taxes
yeah.
for you.
It was listed and was ready to go. They had it out for bid, and the minimum bid was 7,700, and that's what we were basing this on, and so that's why we pulled it. But I believe if he goes back out, re-advertises it, goes out to bid again, he can set that at any amount that he would like to set it at and go out and add $10,000 to it if you want to.
Trustee Green?
You ready to entertain a motion?
I am.
Okay, then I would move that we, within the next 2 weeks, approach the Brown County Treasurer of rebidding this property through his normal process for his Brown County taxes and for what's owed to us on the property. Get his answer to that, and then if his answer is yes, that he can do that, that he follows his normal procedure. If it's no, it comes back here for discussion.
Is that the 17? Okay, is there a second? Trustee Dart seconds. Is that the 17.7?
Well, unless number two comes into play.
Is that our, is the, what's owed us, is that 17.7 or is it?
No, 10 to us.
Ours is 10 to us. Okay, so it would be 17.7. Is that what you're suggesting?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Be the minimum bid.
Because then that keeps the process intact. That gets us where we want to go
right.
in the future, and it starts, it's just so much cleaner.
And if no bids are received for that amount, it comes back here?
Well, if he says he won't do it, then bring it back here for discussion. If he says he will do it, great. Let's go through the process. Because it's still so much under what it's valued at, is my reasoning.
I would like to be clear on number two, too. Is there any others? So that's covered first. Otherwise, then
it's probably
laid out of our 10,000.
Trustee Zeller?
Number two is going to cost us a lot of proceeds. Number two is 1% per month on the delinquent taxes. That's what the county charges, is 1% per month on a delinquent tax amount. So there is not going to be a great deal of proceeds left from the sale, even if he sells it at $17,000, whatever the dollar amount is.
Then your original comment that we should let the county sell it,
I'm willing
and let things
walk
work
away,
out. You understand that we're going to get nothing out of all of this.
I'm willing to walk away with our investment as a lost learning experience on these properties that the owners will walk away from.
Can we get a figure on the interest and penalty?
From Treasurer Blaney?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
The amount that $7,700 is just the principal amount of taxes, so the taxes are $7,600 approximately. So there would be, and he had mentioned that the interest and penalty, he would not. He said, if you want to buy it, I'm not going to put interest and penalty on there. That's just the tax amount. So I do not have the interest and penalty amount on here, but we can certainly get it.
How long has it been delinquent? 1% per month, you said?
1% per month for 36 months. They cannot take any action until the property is delinquent for 36 months.
That's a lot of months.
And keep in mind that tax due or that tax accumulation is based on the property with the house on it. At the valuation of the land plus the improvements.
Even though we took the house down over a year ago?
It was there as of the first of the year.
Oh.
So that $30,000 from our assessor is based on?
Just the land.
No, it was just land.
The total value of that lot in the assessment roll was $78,000 with $50,000 for the house, and the land was at $28,000. That's what it was assessed at last year.
I'm sorry, what was your comment then, Trustee Zell?
So the interest that accrues, that has accrued beyond the $7,700.
Oh, it's based on when the house is on.
Based on the improved value of the property, and it would accumulate over 36 months of non-payment.
It would be before the county took it over.
See, we tore it down with ownership intact. The owner owned the property when we raised the building. But he had not been paying
the taxes,
so those interest and penalties accruing, you know, while we took it down.
Okay. So it sounds like...
Why don't I amend my motion to include 1, 2, and 3 as the minimum bid? If he's willing to do that, that gets us to the process we want it to go through.
Okay.
If he's willing to do it.
Trustee Gingrich, is that?
I was thinking.
I'm sorry, Trustee Dart.
I don't think he will be willing to do that, but I'm willing to.
It's worth asking.
Second that, it's worth asking.
And are there taxes from January till now? Who pays those?
The taxes from January to now?
For 2013.
Who officially owns it right now?
The county.
The county.
So it's their taxes, they own themselves.
When did they take ownership of it, do you know? I would assume that there aren't any taxes due if it's county owned.
Well, then the county owes us taxes for the alloy
portion. That's under number 3.
That's 6.
Can I just make a comment?
Yes.
Logically, if the treasurer is willing to list the property in the in rem auction, is basically what the procedure is called. If he's willing to list the property for $17,500 and he gets no bids for
right.
the property, then we know that the property's not worth $17,500. So why would we stick our neck out and try to sell it, try to buy it and sell it for $15,000 or $16,000 or $17,000 or $20,000 if we don't?
We already spent the $10,000. That's
okay.
Down the drain.
Okay, let's say that we can't sell it for $17,000 or $16,000 or $15,000. Then if we sell it for $14,000 less a realtor's commission, less our $7,700 investment, is it worth it to recover?
You make about $3,000 under that scenario.
So I guess what I'm saying is I don't think we really have a business being in the real estate business. So
we're already in the real estate business.
Yeah. Unfortunately. Reluctantly.
A record isn't great, but they're a pretty unique property in it.
That's why I'd like to see if the Brown County Treasurer would even entertain this if he thinks it would sell.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. I agree with Trustee Dart. I'm not sure it's going to work, but I think maybe it's worth a shot. And if it, well, we might be discussing this again. So. Yeah. Any other further discussion on this item? Trustee Zeller?
The motion to communicate with the Treasurer, mm-hmm. to ask him,
yes.
if he would add the costs together.
Yep. With one, two, and three, and that'd be the minimum bid.
Okay. All right.
And then we'll bring it back.
Yes. If he says no, comes back here.
If he says yes, do we go forward
for
with it, right? Have him go forward with mm-hmm. it. Is that the understanding?
Fine.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Mm-hmm. Motion carries. Thank you, Trustee Zell, for the additional information.
Yeah.
Item 9, action regarding the award of the construction contract for Hastings Street. Is there a motion with regard to this item? Trustee Kopisch?
I'll move to approve.
Is there a second?
I have a question after it's set.
I'll second.
Trustee Gendron seconds. Trustee Zeller.
Okay, Craig, if we could look at the bid, the second bid and the third bid, based on the prior to the alternate bid being added in, I see that David Tenner Corp is the low. But if we intend to go with the alternate bids, if we intend to proceed with that, then we have two other low bidders. How do we work through that?
Well, the alternate bid shouldn't really be called an alternate bid. That is not our cost. That's the cost of private side laterals for property owners that install laterals on sanitary, storm, or water service on their lots. So it's a little bit of a misnomer. It's listed as an alternate bid, but it's not an item that we incur any cost. So the low bid to us for the project is Tenner. These are just the costs for if a resident is going to put lateral in, then those costs are included under that bid item. So it's a little confusing, and we looked at that. I had the same question when I looked at the totals, but really we don't incur those costs on the alternate bids. Those are paid for by property owners.
So we're looking at the top number.
The total.
Yes. Yeah, that's the one you're looking at.
We're not looking at the total. Or the totals,
yeah.
Same number.
I guess I understand what you're saying, Craig. So even though we are assessing the alternate bid amounts, we are the conduit for it. So we are actually paying the contractor the alternate bid amounts. So it could be argued that we're by contract obligated to pay those amounts. So I'm just a little worried about this, as the alternate bid is a sealed or a closed bid number that was provided to us, and it does change the picture as far as what our total contract would be with one of these contractors. Are we in any trouble with regards to those totals and not choosing a low bidder based on what the issuance of the contract would be?
Well, two further thoughts, and one is, in the contracts that we've awarded to date, we've awarded on the basis of this total contract price to us. That's been the basis that we've selected a little better in our previous bids. And I did ask that question of McMahon with regard to how they would look at it, and their comment was awarded on the basis of that little bid to us as the municipality. So that's two other items that came into play in that thought process.
Could you? Can you? The last part. McMahon recommended that you go on the low bid for the total, not the total the, with all.
On the bid to us for the Hastings Street itself, without the alternates, that's what they recommended.
That you go with them because they were the low bid on the
base bid.
On the base bid. Yeah.
You want to call it the base bid? Yeah. I posed that question to them, and they said that would be the way they would interpret it themselves as well.
And historically, that's how we've kind of
and that's
operated.
What we've done. Yeah. And if you look at the alternate bid price, we don't know that that cost is going to be that cost. It depends on how many homeowners put in the lateral.
That's true.
But you don't know if any of the cost.
It makes a difference, but it won't be a $60,000 cost, for example. We're not going to hit that number.
That's sort of irrelevant, though, right? Because if you apply that same logic to all the other bidders, then...
Yeah. The differences will remain the same.
Right.
But whatever number you assume, it's going to be that.
Well, if you're looking at the alternate bid, the number four bidder would be the lowest overall.
Right.
But that's not the basis.
Right.
Trustee Zeller?
So I believe that in our motion to approve or to let the contract to David Tenner, that we have to specify that we are awarding based on the base bid and then state that amount of $284,203.95 and then handle the alternate bid portion of the project as a change order to the project. I believe that's the way that we should do it.
Craig, is just within the alternate bid, the extra, right? And it depends on how many laterals are put in. Do you have any idea how that cost is calculated? Is there sort of a base? Whether you put one in or you put 25 in, it's going to cost you this much, and then per lateral after that? Or is it sort of you divide the $60,000 in the case of David Tenner by the number of laterals, and that sort of cost per lateral, or how does it work?
We give them a number and footage, which is an estimate for that project, for those quantities. We give them an estimate. We total up the number of homes, we take an average length, and we put that in there, and then that's the basis that they quote that portion of the work.
So they're all quoting on the same amount of laterals?
All the same. Everybody's got the same numbers. We don't know how many homeowners are going to go ahead because this was the last project added.
Right.
The residents on that street have a letter from us that outlines that this project was moving forward and that the laterals would be an option for them. And tomorrow night actually is the kickoff meeting with the residents to go over this. And obviously one of the questions we get, and we go through this, the televising reports and the laterals and show them what the condition of their lateral is and that type of thing.
Yeah, I'm not imagining that they give you this level of specificity in their pricing, but my question, there are a couple of different ways that a company could do this. They could say, look, let's say we have 60,000 feet of laterals, and they're going to charge you per foot. One company could say that. The next company could say, I'm going to charge you $10,000 even if we do one lateral that only has 80 feet. And then everything above that, I'm going to charge you 56 cents a foot or something, so that there's a guaranteed base that you were going to pay plus some increment above that. So those are two different pricing models, and that would... Then one company, the final bill for this alternate would be different from one company than the next company. Do you know if have any details about how they're going to be pricing this alternate bid? Because we don't know what the final cost is going to be. It's going to be a maximum of 60 grand for Tenner, right?
Well, yeah, we have the price per foot.
And they all charge on per foot?
All on per foot.
Okay.
They all have
right.
the same quantity, all the... The prices might vary. One contractor might be $5 a foot higher than the other. But
they're all going to charge per foot. Okay.
All per foot.
All right.
And it's all based on the quantity we gave them. Now, there is, as you were asking that question, one thing came to mind, and that is
It depends on the specific home, because some will be open cut construction to the house, some will be bored into the house and no open cut. So that all comes into play based on each property and their decision to proceed and their specific situation that they have in terms of how to get from the road to their house. So that's why this is simply an estimate to get a price based on an estimated number of homes.
Okay.
And each homeowner, until we actually lay it out at their home, we don't know what that cost is. But it's based on the unit prices that we bid.
I guess what I'm asking is, at the end of the day, if we award this to tender, could they have come in under what number four would have come in? Or is it, if they're all going to charge per foot for this other cost, for this alternate bid cost, then it doesn't, if they're going to charge per foot, and one bid's higher than the other, it's going to be higher than the other no matter. Do you understand what I'm saying? So is the pricing structure the same?
Let me answer
or
it this
could,
way.
Could, the Feaker and Sons, could they be charging more if they have to bore through something than
yes.
Tanner is? And
yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. The $60,000 price, $60,089 for the alternate bid for David Tanner Construction, then let's say that all the homes go ahead. That could end up being $50,000. Or some other. It won't end up being $60,089 because some of them will be open cut, some of them will be bored. There might be more of one than the other than what we listed as a tally for them to bid on. And that price is going to vary from what's listed here.
Okay, and then if Feaker and Sons charges more for when they have to bore through something, theirs could be actually what they quoted here.
Yes,
for that
exactly.
Same.
It could
okay.
be higher, yeah.
All right.
It's basically a unit price to be applied. And you know, I didn't realize when this came out as an alternate bid, we should have called it a different term because it is just unit prices for installation of laterals is what it is. So it's going to vary. It won't be the number that we list here. It could vary by easily $5,000 higher or lower in any one of these cases, depending on the final requirements and how the work is actually done. See, and here's part of what happens. We also, when we bid this, we include the cost of going under the foundation and coming up into the home and making the connection within the home. Well, that's included in these costs. But there's a number of homes who can't do that, so that comes off of here. How many, we don't know.
Why wouldn't we be able to do that?
Well, because we don't know which homeowners are going to put laterals in.
Oh, no, I thought you were just saying there's some that you can't do that on, like physically can't do that, or did
well,
I misinterpret
because,
that?
Complications with their plumbing. Obviously, we'd like to. We feel it should go through the foundation and into the house, but sometimes we can't. Sometimes it's a finished basement. They don't want to do that. I mean, it's very unique. Each one has to be worked out to see how it's going to actually be done.
Okay, so there's no physical impediment. It's just they wouldn't want
to. It could
to
be,
it.
Yes.
Okay.
But whatever it applies
yeah.
equally to all of the vendors that quoted it, right?
Yeah.
So that really doesn't make any difference.
The only difference it makes is one guy might charge $2 more per foot for one unit price item, and another contractor might charge $3 less, but it depends on how many we actually do.
Yep, the mix of...
The mix of homes. Okay.
So and each property owner will get an estimate if they want one?
No.
Yes.
And then they'll be assessed. If they move forward, they'll be assessed for that.
Yes.
Trustee Zeller?
And further, when we bill the homeowner for the work done under the alternate bid area, we do not mark up the cost that's passed through the general contractor through the village to the homeowner. I'm comfortable with approving this as a base bid project and letting the subsequent work take care of itself based on whether the homeowner chooses to have it done or not, if that makes any sense. We do charge interest if the resident chooses to delay payment or spread payments out to cover the cost of the alternate bid section. but we do not mark it up or add to the actual cost from the contractor for that.
Right, and that's I understand you're taking it from the homeowner's perspective, mm-hmm. and I agree with that, but then there's also the person who wasn't awarded the bids perspective, mm-hmm. and you add the two numbers together, and there was a low bid. And so there needs to be some explanation for why the potential total cost of the project we're not going with the low bid.
That's why we would have to award it just based on that first totals, mm-hmm. that first totals line. And take the other the alternate out.
Much lower is it?
Not
my
much.
Eyes are failing.
Not much. Here, put my glasses on.
Nice.
Thank you. They look like me.
It's not much lower, so. Yeah, number one's not a lot lower. It wouldn't take too many laterals, and we. Number four is at the end of the day the lower bid. I'm struggling with it. All right, any further discussion? We have a motion and a second. Is that correct, Trustee Zeller? Did you need?
Could we just, Debbie? Could you read the motion, please?
The motion was to award to Dave Tenner Construction.
That's it.
That was it.
It's basically to accept the low bid.
You want to get more specific than low bid, Trustee Zeller?
I believe so. Then I think we're obligated to award it to Feaker and Sons. Then it's based on low bid, if we word it that way.
If we base it on low bid for the base project or whatever we're calling the first total, then it's different.
Yes.
Let's reword it.
Who was it your motion, Trustee Kopisch? Even just for the record, I think we need to be specific as to what your motion was. We have it in the minutes as being David Tenner.
Right.
Your recollection is to award the low bid.
And based on the analysis from the Public Works and the recommendation, it was the other company. So are we going to alter the definition for alternate bid? Or?
Well, why don't you call it total construction bid items 1 through 19? That's the base bid.
You don't have that information. We can't look at what that means. Right? 1 through 19?
Well, that's what's on the bid tabulation, and that's what's in the contract.
Okay, and that's where we come up with that top number where it says total?
Right.
I mean,
and then use that number. It's right in the bid document. So it's total construction bid Hastings Street, items 1 through 19, $184,203.95.
So we're awarding it to David Tenner based on the low base bid.
Is that your motion, Trustee?
Based on
sure.
The low base
based
bid.
On the recommendation of the Public Works Committee to award it to David Tenner. For 284.
And I would presume part of that has to do with the quality of the work and the timeline with the present assignments in the village.
Yeah. Trustee Gendrich, do you?
Yeah, I concur.
Okay. Craig, have we been doing any work with Beaker and Sons? You mentioned that we're doing some stuff with Tenner. Currently on Bitters and St. Matthews.
Yeah, Tenner is doing the current project. Dorner is just completing the project with us. Ed Gerzek did our maintenance work this year. The group has done several, they do our emergency repair work. Beaker and Sons did a stormwater project for us. The major piping on the Mako detention pond. They did the piping work for that project. Years ago, they did street work for Alloway, but not since I've been here.
But these are all qualified vendors, obviously. Trustee Zeller?
Just one clarification. Steve, you had mentioned that that this was based on the recommendation of the Public Works Committee,
yes.
But it wasn't, though. We did not review this. This is coming straight to the Village Board.
Why is that?
I think that's a time issue. It was based on the publication of the project and sending that out to it's a timeliness issue.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Further discussion? The motion on the floor is to award the bid to David Tanner Construction for 284,203.95. That would be items 1 through 18. Is that correct, Craig?
1 through 19.
1 through 19. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion passes.
1 no.
1 no. Craig, you need a motion with regard to the lateral work?
No, I don't think so.
Thank you. Action regarding Riverside Drive Project Advisory Committee assignments. Is there a motion with regard to this item?
Also move.
I'll second. Discussion? Trustee Kopisch?
Is there an opportunity to add others? I know we had talked about a retired DOT engineer potentially having interest in getting involved with. I thought was pretty well qualified. I don't see his name there.
Yeah, this was a request at the meeting of a couple weeks ago, a request of the DOT that we put together two committees that would work with the consulting firm and the DOT on the project. And so we did assemble. Tracy and I sat down and went through this. This is a list we came up with, holding these out of committees that the village presently have. So kind of brainstormed on who we thought would be good on these committees. One committee focuses on roadway, one roadway alternatives and public outreach program. One focuses more on the community sense of design, which is bikes, sidewalks, lighting, things of that sort. These are from the committees. The recommendation to you is to think about citizen members that you might want to appoint as well. And the guidance we were given from the DOT is 5 to 20 people. Well, if we take this list and if we add some individuals to it tonight yet, and then we send an invitation to all these people and ask them to reply back that they would like to participate, we may not get all of the people on here anyway. So that's the process. As soon as we have the list, then we would immediately draft a letter that would explain the number of meetings, the function. There's going to be 4 meetings for each committee, basically, is what it's going to be. And invite them to participate at the request of the village board in this program, reply to us, and then there'll be a meeting yet this August for the first committee. So that's kind of the game plan. We will get this out in the next couple of days. And there is one name that was suggested to us that's not on the list, and that is Lynn Heyer from the Beautification Committee to be involved in the Community Sensitive Solutions team. But, yeah, I guess we would ask if you have individuals you'd like to add to it, let's put them on the list.
I would suggest Steve Knoll.
They did a really good job of presenting. Were you there, Trustee Kopisch? I can't remember. It was a couple weeks ago. And they did a really good job presenting, and they... Were you there? No?
I don't think so. Me?
Trustee Gendron.
I was there, yeah.
No, you were there, Trustee Kopisch. Yeah. They did a really good job of presenting, and this is kind of the way that when we asked them, how do you typically form these committees? And they said, well, you already have some folks who are invested in the village already and know a lot about these issues, sort of glean some folks from those committees and then expand to the residents. Craig's right, it's really important that we need to get resident involvement, so any names that you might have. I had to leave that meeting about 10 minutes early. I noticed that I got put on this, so I'm going to withdraw my second.
There was a reason for that. We did try to do a couple things. We did want the Public Works Committee members to be involved.
Yeah.
One committee or the other. We wanted that because we felt that was important in the decision-making process. And then, secondly, we do want village trustees involved.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question of who wants to be involved, but we did want to do that. And that's why you were at the previous meetings. We thought that would make sense to do that, but you can also take your name off if you'd like. It's kind of confusing.
And we haven't contacted these folks yet, and they haven't committed this yet. This is an initial list, and like Craig said, not everyone's going to be committed to serving. Trustee Zeller.
I'd like to add the county board representatives from District 14 and 15. Both of those districts would be that the roadway would pass through those two.
We're going to be without one, but that's what I mean. District 15, the Northern District, is resigning.
But they had applications submitted last week. Hopefully they'll fill that quickly.
Was it due last week?
It was due last week.
I was
going
to say that. It would have been a good announcement to have.
Yeah.
Okay, and if you think of any other suggested resident names, just let me think right now.
They were also talking about representatives from DePere, but is that up to DePere to...
Yeah,
DePere has to select them. The DOT will put them on this list, yeah. And that'll be two or three people, I believe, is all that's going to be.
And they'll probably be employees.
They'll be employees, yeah.
Trustee Dark?
Trustee Kobitz, did you mean Steve Knowles should be on the first committee, not the second, right?
Either one. Whatever's most appropriate. You know it. Craig knows him.
Yeah,
I know
too,
so
thinking
being on traffic and safety,
so we'll
find around this particular one. How about folks that live on Riverside? Have we...
There's Cliff Wall is on here.
Cliff Wall is on here.
Michael Troop has a business on Riverside, and he also lives just off of Riverside on Selden. I also got a name from Economic Development when we talked about it at their meeting, Tom Gertz. Who I understand is the owner of a business on Riverside, on Alloway Avenue in Riverside. That came up. One of the members had mentioned him at the meeting.
Yeah. It'd be nice to have a couple residents who just live on there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Cliff was one that is a homeowner on there. I don't think we had anybody else, but if anyone knows of somebody else that would be a homeowner, that would be great.
Yeah, I think that would be great.
And Becky Mert, I know I'm going to put her on with the Walks of Life. I have John Tresker on there. I know she was, and I just thought of her. But
I'd say ask her.
Okay, any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Too late.
Item 11. We'll take 11A through C unless there are objections. Is there a motion with regard to items 11A through C? I will make a motion to approve and place on file. Is there a second? Trustee Gennard, seconds. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Reports and discussion. Update on the turkeys. He's not the turkey guy. I'm supposed to tell him that every time.
Look at the part.
Let me come up here because this can be a little bit easier. I met last week. I met last week with Dan Hertrick from the DNR. He's the nuisance and wildlife specialist. Took him around the village, had a nice conversation regarding both deer and turkey. Because it came in our last meeting when Steve and I met with James from the DNR. Who lives in Alloway? It was suggested that if you're going to do the turkey, you may as well take care of the other problem that you have, or potential problem. I don't want to say it's a problem, but a potential problem, which is the deer.
Mm-hmm.
So combining the two seasons or combining them would make the most sense. So that was part of the discussion, and what I tried to do is give you a little background or some of the items that we discussed. Obviously, you know, the increased deer population and turkey populations in communities is nothing new. So there's tons and tons of communities that have, are entering this arena, whether they're allowing, changing their ordinances so they're allowing some hunting in their community, or they're dealing with either sharpshooters or other means of controlling the populations. So there's tons of information out there in order to put together a good program. I went on the city of Duluth, Minnesota, has an unbelievable website designated to their deer management program. So anyone wants to see any of the information, I've got some of it that I printed off. Otherwise, if you want to check out the city of Duluth, really walks through. I mean, they've got several years of documentation of how many deer, how many were taken, what, you know, what they do with them. I mean, it's a very successful program. Some of the other things that we talked about, what has sparked the interest in wanting to do the potential control of both deer and turkeys in the community. And by the way, when I took him around, we went down Bull Parade, and there was turkeys on both sides of the road. So he says, when he shows up, you never see him. So yeah. it was nice to at least show that there are several around the area. But, you know, what sparked the interest? Is it number of calls of people having them in their yards? Is it gardens being destroyed? Is it deer car collisions? Is it deer turkey car turkey collisions? You know, what is it? So his recommendation is to try to gather as much of that documentation as you can, because what you want to do is maintain the wildlife as a positive. How does it go? Keep the perception of wildlife in your community positive. Because it is. I mean, people like to look at them. I love to look at them. It's just something that it's there for us to view. So when you're putting together your program, it is, what is your intent? It's to the extreme of total elimination or control. So you have to find that happy medium somewhere in between in there that makes sense for your community. So with that in mind, have you done a survey? No, we have not done a survey. We haven't gone that far. But the city of De Pere just got done doing a Survey Monkey. And they had, and I've got a copy of their survey that they did. And I want to say there was 662 responses. So they had a pretty good response in a short period of time. I've got their questions, so it's getting more of this documentation together. Setting up public meetings. We've had three, I think, now here, but we haven't invited the general public. There hasn't been a mass email or a mass mailing that's gone out to specific neighborhoods, so that would be a good thing for us to do. With that being said, when you're putting together these public meetings, then you want to start to reach out and put together a committee, an ad hoc committee, because there's a lot of stuff that's involved with this, from the administration of the program to the education of the program, and there's just a lot of work for an individual to do. I don't want to be a turkey guy, but I'd certainly be on the committee. So that's yet another step. It's a positive step. That each one of these things that Dan brought up are positive things to get to a potential end result, which is either you do it or you don't do it, and if you're going to do it, you're doing it in a positive manner, those sort of things. So survey, setting up a committee, aerial survey. How many deer or turkey are present in the village? Well, right now you're seeing virtually the jakes and the toms, because the little chicks are, I don't know what to call them. What do you call a little chicken? Or a turkey. Little turkey, I guess. But, you know, they're being raised right now, so you're really not seeing a true number of turkeys that are in the community. So an aerial survey is a real good method to get a better idea on your numbers. Will you see the number of turkeys? Probably not, but you would with the deer because you do it in the wintertime. Marty from the city of DePere is looking at applying for a grant to an aerial survey, and that might be a prime opportunity for us to jump onto that survey. You know, it may cost us a little bit of money, a couple $1,000s, because I think his estimate right now is $5,000 to do an aerial survey. Grant would pay up to 50% of that, so maybe us joining in, it could be a little bit less yet. So that's another positive thing that's coming up with getting true data that's out there. Changing an ordinance or creating an ordinance. I believe we don't have the no feeding wildlife, but that is something that, again, it's a first step positive approach to helping control the nuisance. So I've got some examples of some ordinances, but again, that committee, if we put it together, could work on some of that stuff as well. A lot of them just refer to the state no feeding wildlife state statute. I can't remember 1960 or whatever it is, 19.60. But again, that's another one. If we do set up a season, because we are part of the urban or the metro herd control, the season extends greatly beyond the typical deer hunting season, which is 9 days. The metro unit takes you all the way till,
I think it's like the
11th of January. And what you can look at expanding that even further. But trying to have a season within, you know, when people are used to the season taking place,
yeah,
makes sense. So those are, again, another one of those items. Just the investigating as far as what lands are available. You know, we've got a lot of public land that, you know, you would have to circle, you know, really come up with a defined area that you would allow this to take place. But then you're going to have to reach out to the residents as well.
Yeah.
Because if you've got a thoroughfare, you know, and that's all, the thoroughfare, or the main passage is through private property, you're not going to be able to control the problem maybe as well as if you had the buy-in from those private residents as well, or private property as well. So that's a lot of work that you're going to have to start to do. You know, you've got a lot of nonprofit land around here that is wooded as well. So there are some things that need to be looked into. Apply for grants whenever possible. I've got all the grant applications from the DNR. You know, there is money invested both ways. There's money invested into writing the grant, but yet you're successful with the grant, you still have some additional funds, but again, it's a way to help cover a lot of our costs. You know, one of the things that he has talked about that you really want to keep in mind is what is the total cost associated with running the program? You know, if we are running this program, staff time is involved, we're doing aerials, we're doing all this other stuff, you all of a sudden you have this exorbitant number versus bringing in sharpshooters.
Mm-hmm.
The sharpshooters is, you know, that's another thing that tends not to be a real positive in some cases, but it's very effective, or can be, I should say.
Simpler.
So those were a lot of things. I know I've got a resident that we've talked a few times that's very interested in the program. As far as numbers, to be quite honest with you, I haven't, for the years that I've been here, I haven't really kept track of all those calls, so I couldn't even venture to guess how many we've received over the years. But we're keeping track now.
But has it been a handful a year? Has your phone been ringing off the hook every year?
Absolutely. There's a handful every year.
Handful, okay.
But that could be a handful of people in the case of these turkeys that can't let their kids out in their own yard because it's full of turkeys. So even if it's only five a year, that's concerning to me. And the first man with whom we met talked about, he asked some questions about the herds or the flocks of turkeys that we had seen. And commented that those, they're too big. I mean, it's not good for the flock itself to have that many all in one spot, and the flock itself is probably in distress, and sort of insinuated that it might self-correct because there's. But he said it's just not a good. It's not good for the animals either. Or healthy for the animals. They're going to be carrying diseases and things like that. So there are some other issues going on with the current flocks that we have, even if they're only affecting a handful of people a year.
Oh yeah, and don't get me wrong. That's not to minimize how many. I just like to get kind of a scope. And actually, Duluth, the website that you said, this thing is excellent. It looks like it's administered by a Bow Hunters Alliance that does the orientation and the permitting, and then so it's a joint venture between a nonprofit and a municipality.
Correct.
That seems to me to be a whole different, and may help you out as far as staff-wise.
Well, they harvest,
say they did a great job.
Harvest 300 deer, though, too. I mean,
it's huge.
A little different deal.
It's a little different game.
Yeah.
This is coming at a good time, though, because this really started with the turkey problem. But,
right.
You know, our neighbors to the north and our neighbors to the south, who probably have less wooded parkland in their municipalities percentage-wise, are running into deer problems.
Well, that's one of my
And
concerns.
So this is coming down. This is,
oh, yeah.
As they flush them out of those municipalities, they're going to be going somewhere, the ones that they don't catch, and that's going to be here. So
well,
I like this sort of positive approach, but it's also very proactive in that we're
correct.
Dealing with a problem now before it actually becomes a significant problem in the village.
Well, we've got them. It was interesting because last meeting we left talking about this. You know, I tend to come home fairly late from work sometimes. There was turkeys in the road and a deer running right down the middle of Webster, and we get a couple.
Almost a deer-turkey collision.
Yeah, like this is just too coincidental. But you know, I've lived off Webster for quite a while, and every single year I feel bad for the deer because we have at least two that I know of, which means there's a ton more than that, and they are too popular, and they get up there and they get scared and then they get hit by cars and. Not only property damage, but yeah, the herds are—they're not well taken care of.
Trustee Copus?
Yeah, a question. One of my concerns is differentiating the alloway deer and turkey from Bellevue's. Are they doing anything in terms of control? Because it would seem to me because they're going back and forth across the river right. all the time. If you're going to do some control, we would do something with them, ND Pier, and
Green Bay.
Survey.
It certainly is something that I need to look further into. When the DNR was up here last week, I was telling them a little bit of a story. We moved in here already, so it's been within the last 7 years. There was this time period within those last 7 years that 18 known large bucks were taken from Alloway up through Scray's Hill. And what they were doing is they were shooting them and just removing the head. So you have the carcass left behind.
Mm-hmm.
We've had one in Green Isle that I know of.
I saw
that's right.
Yeah.
We had the one down here on the end of Dauphin 2 years ago, I think now. Which we caught them. So that's some of the other things that may happen is you may find people doing this and it's not controlled. So
right.
You know, you certainly want to again be proactive in the approach. Working with Bellevue, Green Bay's already got their deer hunting program, and they've been running it for several years. I don't know. Their numbers as far as how successful it is, but you know, they've got a lot of acreage. But working with Bellevue De Pere certainly makes a lot of sense.
Any further comments?
Just to mention some more damage that the turkeys did. When we had Plan Commission, we had a little bicycle tour, and we were across the street here, and the turkeys they keep replanting the berm, but the turkeys take all of the something off the side of the hill that the berm keeps dying off. So
I think what you mentioned, you know, there's about 20 of them over there.
Yeah, when we were at our tour, we looked over the berm, and in the back there, just beyond it, were about 20 turkeys sitting in there. And the comment we got from that developer over there was his residents love the turkeys because they sit in the back and they watch them go by, and they just... So there's one vote against getting rid of any because he really likes them back there.
There's a lot of deer down there, too.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. Yeah,
they like it. That's the balance you got to try to find.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's the perception of keeping it in a positive, in a positive manner, and you know the education aspect of it's not about eliminating, it's about controlling. So I guess what I would hope to do is at the next meeting, if we can take care of some of these. Put together a committee that starts working forward, mm-hmm. put some timelines, you know, start to reach out to the public to see who we might have available.
I'm first on the list.
Again, yeah, I've received some emails from, because it's been in the paper, it's been on the news a few times. I like the turkeys, I like the deer. And I respond back, I do too. You know, it's mm-hmm. not about trying to get rid of all this. Again, it's about a little more control. So that's where we're at. If I don't know how quickly we can move on any of this stuff because it does take time. The DNR has been great to work with. Very helpful.
Yeah.
You know, could we be set up for maybe a later metro season? It's possible. It's really possible. It depends on what the time of the year that they're going to, well, I know it's in the winter months, that they'll do the aerial, but you know, trying to gather some of this other data and put it together with the committee and make some recommendations. So,
do you know DePere's timeline on the grant application?
The grant applications are due late September into November. So,
okay. Well, that might be a nice target for the committee to see if we can coordinate something with DePere.
I'll try to have some of that in line for the next meeting so that there could be some actions that we can move forward with the grants and you know applying the grants or working jointly with some of the other communities.
Okay, thanks, Brian.
All right.
For not being the turkey guy, you really are good at being
the turkey guy.
Discussion regarding the organizational charts. Tracy, do you want to start us out?
Basically, what you have in front of you, you have two different organizational charts. Number two, which is listed as Appendix B organizational chart, is the chart that is currently in our personnel manual. As you can see, it's a little hard to read. It's not really great design, and we did that, and at the time, we didn't have a program that really would work or someone that could get it set up differently. So once we got our new receptionist, I went to her and said, hey, can you come up with a design or a different organizational chart structure that maybe would be a little clearer, a little easier to look at and to read? So she worked on a different structure, or different design, which is number one there. Basically, number two, as you can see, has the fire department listed on it still, and there are some other changes that have occurred. The court clerk, deputy clerk is no longer a shared position. The code enforcement officer is not in there. So there's been some changes to that, and my idea when I initially started this was just to update the table of organization as well as make it more readable. So we came up with what you have in front of you and then talked about it at some staff meetings and then some comments and were brought up at that time, as you can see on the front page. So Steve and I kind of kicked it around, and he had some comments and some changes that he anticipated as well. So tonight we just want to get some input from you on the organizational chart, any suggestions that you have. One of the things that we talked about was we have an awful lot of contracted positions that we have through the village, whether it's our fire department, police department, we have our assessor that's contracted, our building inspector, we have our weights and measures, we have our animal control. So we have a lot of those types of positions, and showing them maybe off to the side as contracted positions that we do have, but not necessarily within our organizational structure. So, like I said, there are other comments, and I know Steve has some comments he wants to make. So it's really a discussion item to see what your thoughts are on it. My whole goal at the beginning of this whole thing was just to update what we had in there and make it show our current. So that's what number one was, to really just take what we had and make it current. And maybe we want to expand on that a little bit or change it out or do some other things. So that's why it's here tonight, just to discuss a little further and see what your thoughts are on it.
Another purpose of the organizational chart I find is that it's helpful for people who work here or for the board to look at once in a while to remind yourselves where people are in the organization. And for someone who doesn't necessarily work at the village, they kind of understand how there are different departments and how they're structured, and that we do have positions that seem like they're village employees, but they're not, and they're contracting services. And so I like the layout of this much better, but there are some other issues that I think we need to address as to how we want to organize the village. And for example, most people don't know that the municipal court is completely separate from the village of Alloway. I think that you can go tell the judge to, you know, quit being so harsh on him, Marty. That's just not how it works. And
And then the question is, you know, should our org chart show what we currently have, or should it be what we would like to have? Craig has talked to me about looking at some changes for DPW and the water utility for possible revisions on the org chart. You know, is that something we want to really look at, you know, what we would want it to be, or what we currently have it at, is the question as well.
So part of this is the personnel manual. It's, you know, it needs to be in the personnel manual.
Right.
And what do you put in there? Well, the only thing we can really put in there is what we know is true, but that's old. And so it needs to be updated. So then the next question is, do we update it as of right now, or do we update it based on what we want to see happen? I think Craig has some good ideas of kind of some restructuring in his area, and I for one think that the front desk personnel, I'm not sure they should report directly to the administrator. I think there should be another avenue for the management of the front desk folks. And I do think we need to have the contracted employees on here, especially those that are working a job that someone would assume is a village employee, to be on here somewhere.
So right now, does it accurately represent how it's structured at this point in time?
The contracted folks. Huh?
Except
yes,
for the contractor.
Building inspection is the one contracted that's in here.
And that
so
should,
that
should
one
be here.
Probably be pulled out. I believe that the way it's shown right now is what is occurring.
So I believe at one point payroll and accounts payable clerk went under finance, but we moved it. Because to me that makes sense that should be under there.
Yes.
Instead of directly to you. I don't remember why it was moved, but
originally when
I first started, the payroll accounts payable was under the administrator.
Oh.
And then when we had a retirement, then we kind of looked at the position again and kind of added some different things or tweaked it a little bit. And at that time, we decided it probably would fit better under the finance director. So then it was pulled back under the finance director. And then in the interim, it was shifted back to the administrator.
Okay.
And then discussions that at some time it would potentially go back to the finance director once the finance director was ready to take that role on. So that was kind of the long-range plan, I guess, for that position.
Craig, are you at the point where you're ready to share some of your recommendations for changes within your area that would affect your organizational chart?
Well, a couple are thoughts, but the one that I think, let's say the first one, the one that's probably the most important at this point in time, is I would like the billing clerk, water utility, billing clerk, bookkeeper, to be part of the water utility staff and report to the foreman. Because I think that makes the most sense. That's usually the direct line of communication. And a major portion of the utility bookkeeper's work is scheduling all the appointments for service calls and so forth. And so that really kind of builds the communication. And I think years ago, 10 years ago, that's the way it was organized at one time.
So that would be under water utility foreman, not water utility staff? Or would it be included in water utility staff?
It's included in water utility staff.
Okay, so instead of the bookkeeping position, instead of would be, but under water utility staff, then there'd be four.
Yes.
And that wouldn't be represented separately. You would just move that person into that box.
Do you know why it is? Is it goes through, it's associated with street department staff and goes to the street department foreman?
No, it's on that line that goes up and reports directly to me.
Oh, okay.
And, and that works. And that was done when the change was made 5 years ago, or whatever it was, to put the water utility bookkeeper directly under me because of the communication issues and as a better way to manage that person. But since then, we've looked at it and we felt this would be better to go this route. It
makes sense to me.
I think it would improve the function. That makes sense.
Do you have any other things that you're looking at?
Well, I want to explore the combining the engineering tech and CAD operator together, have the CAD operator report to the engineering tech and then report to me. And that's what I want to explore and look at that. And I think that makes some sense because that work relationship there is hand in hand. It makes sense to have, usually a designer reports to the engineer. That's normally how that's done. And I think that would improve the function of that department. But that is a change in concept, so that's something we need to look at.
Right, and that's why it's under the discussion section, although we need to get something, and this is not something that you just decide on and then you change. You're going to have to bring these ideas back and make sure that people know what the ideas are, and that they can provide insight. I mean, there are some reasons we're not thinking of why these recommendations are a bad idea. But I think we need to have those conversations sooner rather than later, because I'd like to get this nailed down and into the manual and moving forward, with the understanding it can always change somewhat. But Tracy, do you feel like you have a sense of some of the things that were?
Sure. So it sounds like you would like in the manual a document that maybe isn't necessarily what it is right now, that it's something that maybe out of it, like for instance the CAD operator and the engineer tech. Are we going to move that right away, or is that we're going to put it in the organizational chart in that manner and that's something we're striving to do?
No, I don't think it should go in the manual until it's decided on that that's the structure. How soon do you think we can have the conversation so that we can make decisions about the actual structure? I mean, is it reasonable to do this at our next meeting?
What about, as part of the budget process, too? So we're looking at departments and positions.
Yeah, I don't know.
And job descriptions, that's...
Yeah, I mean, I think it may take longer than that, than the next meeting, to talk and see what fits where and... So, staff has a chance to see it.
Then my inclination is to just sort of put number one in for right now with the understanding that this is a...
Where it is.
...draft. It's in the... We know that it's going to change. It doesn't make any sense to have number two in there because it just simply isn't an act where I'm doing it.
Well, maybe with one, we could just make the one change, take the building inspector... Or the building inspector on to a contracted services box and just keep that off like the side of the administrator or something as a separate, and then leave everything else. The other thing that came up, and I don't know if it's typically an organizational chart of seasonal staff, that came up too. We just went down as far as like full-time staff, like you see park staff, utility staff, street department staff. We did not include seasonal staff in there. And I don't know if we should or not. We do have some seasonal staff that the Parks Department has and the Public Works Department has. then you have, you know, crossing guards and, you know, that are a seasonal type staff. If we list, you know, just sure. underneath another subcategory, seasonal staff or...
You know, I know that it can get kind of crowded, but for me, the more information, the better, so I can get a clear picture of everyone who's contributing to the village and sort of what the lines of communication are. So I would, my inclination would be to add those. I also think that we have to have some discussions about the front desk personnel and whether there is another person aside from the village administrator. To me, it doesn't make all much sense at all to have the front desk personnel reporting directly to the administrator. I know at one time they were reporting to you, Debbie, is that correct? And I don't know if there's a reason why that changed, but I think we need to explore that option and any others that there might be for that. And then Craig's recommendations of the water utility bookkeeper, that makes perfect sense to me. And then mm-hmm. whether or not the combining of the CAD and engineering, or putting CAD operator under engineering tech is makes sense or not, I don't know. I mean, I want to hear from Craig about that.
One that's current, and then we'll work on one for the future that will
yeah. Yeah.
have some of these other things we discussed. Get that done as soon as we can.
Yeah. Yeah, make sure you get the input from the folks involved. I mean, it's definitely a management decision, but I think it's best to make sure that we get people's insight as to whether or not we're missing something. Anything further?
Moving
the
payroll accounts payable clerk
second
and the finance director also?
Yeah, that was part of the...
Okay.
Part of the immediate change or the...
No,
future?
Not part of the immediate change, I don't think. No.
It was a thing that needs to be discussed.
Yeah. This, yeah, what's on number one is what we're going... with right now is just swapping out because the other one's completely old, but with the understanding that this is going to change hopefully relatively quickly to incorporate, I think, the four areas of changes that we had. One was the contracted folks and the seasonal staff. The other was the front desk. The third was Craig's area. I guess he had two in that area. And then the fourth was the accounts payable clerk. Reporting to the finance director. To me, though, there might be others, though, as you have these conversations with the staff, there might be reasons to not do what one of the four things that we recommended or to do something in addition to them. I don't know. We just need to have the conversations and nail this down relatively quickly. Okay? All right. The PTO policy development updates. If you recall, I think the goal was for the first of the year to have our PTO policy in place. Is that correct, Tracy?
Yes.
Basically, with the PTO program, we... there's a gentleman that I know from Kenai County that is kind of the guru of PTOs and human resource type things. So I contacted him in April or so, and we set up a time for him to come up and do a training or just do an informational presentation with our staff, as also with the administrators in the area. Unfortunately, the day he came was the day that the fire was, and we ended up not being able to go through his presentation. And he did it for the administrators, but then he left as things started to get out of control with the fire, so everybody else had to run a different direction. So we never did have the presentation from him. The presentation is attached to your memo. Since that time, we've been back and forth, him and I, to get a date. He's going to try to get a date before. He has since taken a different job. He's no longer in Calumet County. And we were trying to get a date in and get him back up here before he retired or moved from Kenai County, and it just wasn't possible to have it. In the meantime, he's taken a job with a consulting firm, Carlson Detman Consulting, who does a lot of comp plans and a lot of HR and all kinds of different things. So he has taken that sense. He is willing to talk to him about working with us on putting together a PTO program and working with the committee that we do have, and helping us go through the process and give us some ideas, working with the village board, getting some ideas and feedback from them as well, on PTO and which route you would like to go, as well as working with the committee on which route they would like to go. His proposal is way at the back, I think the last page, kind of listing exactly what he would propose doing. His fee is listed in there. As he stated, the initial estimate was about $7,400, but with his just starting there and them him being new to the organization, they said they'd give us a reduced rate on that, and just because he's worked with me in the past, wanted to help us out with the fire and stuff, he said he'd be willing to work with us. So that's his proposal to help us get a program, look at a program, look at the cost of it, look at policy development, help with the committee to do some consensus building readiness, look at what we have, what the potential is, if it becomes something that we want to go, between the legislative adoption and also employee orientation to the new manual. So taking us through the whole process and helping us to do the research, get the information together that can help us move forward and look at what we have right now and do some costing on that, as well as costing for a new type of program. So that is my suggestion, that we look towards Patrick to see if he can help us out with getting our PTO program going, if indeed that's where we end up. And he will do an initial presentation with the board to say, here's some of the things to really look at and really talk you through it and look at what we have. And he said then at that point you will decide whether you want to continue on or if you feel, well, maybe it's not the way we want to go. So that would be one of the first steps in the process.
Trustee Dart?
I have a question about how we currently do things. So, and I'm sure we talked about this before, but I don't remember. For accruing sick leave, how much can be accrued and how long? And
I should have bought my manual on. And anybody can chime in. Basically, it's 8 hours a month that you can accrue for just about everybody. Then there's different totals, different...
max.
Yes, max.
The reason I'm asking that is I'm thinking if you accrue, and I don't know what you can do for vacation time either, but if you're accruing stuff this year and then using it like 6 months for your retirement, aren't you just getting a higher rate of pay? Or does it accrue at the amount you accrued it at? So if you're working, you know, 10 years ago when you were making X, but you accrued this time off, are you paid out at the current rate or at the original rate?
When you are paid out like, for sick leave, it would be at your current rate, whatever amount you have.
So the more we're accruing, the more expensive it's getting for us. And if people used it, it would be actually less expensive for us.
Potentially, yeah.
I mean, wondering how potentially, I mean, that the answer is yes,
yes
right?
It is,
I
yes,
mean, by
yes,
definition.
Yes. Yes.
Unless
yes,
people get paid less in the future than they did in the past, then, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And, okay, you know, long-term employees, that can be a big deal.
Yeah. It makes good sense to me to have him in and give an initial... Is he willing to come in and give a presentation about what he would do, or what's the initial step for this?
What he said when I spoke with him in regard to starting it, he said one of the early things he would do would be come in and talk to the board and go through, here's some of the options, or here's what he would recommend, or looking at this would be something that he would look at.
But that would be after we actually signed the contract to work with him.
Yeah, and he said, then let's say you decide, he does all the initial work and gives information to you, and you decide, we're just not going to go with PTO. It's not the way we want to do it. Then that whatever was not done in the contract, we would not pay for. He's like, but you, with whatever he had done just for that initial assessment, then that would be what you would pay for. So if we didn't carry through and go on to employee orientation because we didn't change it, there wasn't the policy development, there wasn't, you know, any of that, because early on in the process it was decided, you know, we're just not going to go there. That's not something we want to consider. Then he wouldn't continue on with it.
The major problem with this is transitioning through it, isn't it? Really, it's like what we have and how we treat what we have now, and transitioning.
Or I think one of the concerns that probably staff has that came up at our staff meeting was, you know, you just spoke of this sick leave. There are a lot of people that have worked here for a while and have a fair amount of sick leave that they have accumulated. And that's a concern that they have, that the village board is just all of a sudden going to wipe that out and say, it's gone, you know, we're changing to this, it is no longer there. And I think that's something that, you know, the board could at least touch on this evening. But typically when communities or even private businesses, if they have as much sick time, but just seeing the other communities, when they go to a PTO, they don't just wipe out everybody's sick leave. They move it into maybe an extended leave bank, or they move it into a different name bank that they keep that sick leave in it. So it is available for those people, and they are not losing it. And there's a lot of different ways you can do that. Some of them maybe pay out some of it at a certain point, or some of them say, okay, we're capping it at this much, anything above it we're paying out, or whatever. There's a lot of different ways to look at it, just depending on what the village board would like to do with that. But I don't think it's my intention, or I don't believe from the board, to ever totally wipe out everybody's sick leave and just say, you know, it's gone and it's not there. But that, I think, is one of the fears that the staff has.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it the fear that it's going to be completely wiped out, or is there a fear that it's just not going to be the same as what it would have been if we hadn't gone to a PTO? That I'm going to get paid out less for it, I'm going to have to actually take some of it, or I'm going to lose it, or...
I'm sure it's partly changed, but I think the comments, and you guys have heard them, so you can certainly chime in, that maybe it's not going to be there anymore, that they're, what they've accumulated is going to be gone. And is that what you folks have heard?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the primary concern, then.
From my perspective, it's just how much it's earned.
It's already earned.
We can't
change the past.
Compensation
the future.
That they've earned, and it, we can't.
There's just a couple of questions, just trying to frame this up and understanding, you know, what our objectives are. Will we be looking at more, I guess, oversight, overview relative to time and attendance, keeping track of what people are doing? You know, I don't know. I personally don't know how, you know, time is reported. If you're going to the dentist for an hour, is that paid time off, or somebody's got a sick kid and they're picking people up, is all that, you know, really strictly, recorded?
It is, and if you go to the dentist, you put in, you can use sick time for that. If your child is sick, you can use sick time, and it is recorded. You put together a green slip, and the green slip is given to your supervisor, and they sign off, and then it goes through the process. So, yeah, it is. It's tracked and kept track of. You know, the PTO is going to let more flexibility in that case. So right now, if you... For sick leave, there's certain things you can use it for, and there's certain things you cannot. So let's say my great-grandmother was ill, and I had to go help her with something. I technically could not use sick leave for that. It has to be someone within my household. It has to be a parent, a spouse, or a child for me to use my sick leave for that. But with PTO, I could use that for my great-great-grandmother to go help her out, because it wouldn't matter what I'm using my time for, because it's not in the silos of time that are strictly segregated. You can only use this for this and this for this and this for that. So it does create greater flexibility for users, and it also creates some flexibility for the managers, but a little more accountability for the managers as well. So it's a different system for them to work in as well. So that'll be a learning curve for managers as well as the staff using it. But I think overall, people that have used it, I just talked to the mayor of Appleton, Mayor Hanna. They recently put PTO in. I think it's been a year now. And I asked him how it was going, and they just did it all at one time. He's like, I wasn't going to mess this piecemealing this in. We decided to go totally to PTO. We weren't going to take any steps. And he said they have found that there's a lot less use of the time and that people really like it. So they've had some really positive comments that have come back in regard to their implementation of the policy. So.
There's less use of the time? You think there would be more because in the current system, if I run out of sick leave and I get sick, too bad. Or if I run out of vacation time, because they're in silos. And so you think you just wouldn't have as many options and you'd lose less under a non-PTO system than you would under a PTO. But he said they're actually using less off time.
Yes, and he said he thought it was because it was new and people were kind of gradually getting used to it.
Oh, okay.
And that's why there was less use of it and they were getting, you know, they want to wipe out everything, so they're kind of leery about how they were using it.
Was right, the end of the year. Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe once they get more used to it, the use may be back, you know, where it was. But he said at this point it was less use that they were experiencing with it.
Trustee Gass mentioned at some point, someone mentioned that he mentioned about instead of a PTO system, devising a simpler sick leave system than we have now. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone remember the details of that? I don't. Debbie,
Craig does.
Craig, you do?
The idea, at least one part of that concept, is you would potentially trade off some sick leave that you accumulate. You know, it wouldn't be 8 hours a month. It would be a lesser number for sick leave that you would be granted each year. But there would be short-term disability insurance. So let's say you had 6 days of sick leave for the year, but you were sick more than 6 days, there would be short-term disability insurance that would cover that additional time off. It's a simpler process to implement that type of a change than it is to make the full step to PTO. And that was what his point was. There may be a step in there or some modification in there that would be simpler to do, and maybe PTO is a longer-term thing. I think that's part of what he was thinking of. Because if you look at what are you trying to accomplish and what are the issues that are on the table, well, it's what's the appropriate amount of sick leave and what type of insurance do you provide if you reduce the amount of sick leave? That's what the City of Green Bay has done. And then the topic that we talked about, which was vacation. If you modify the vacation and make it more uniform across the board, those changes, you know, would be part of that as well. That, I think that's where he was coming from. There might be an intermediate step that might be easier to implement. At least should be thought about.
I think capping the sick leave to where your long-term disability plan kicks in is just...
Or short-term.
Short-term. Well, it depends. If it's 3 months, I don't know when it starts, but when does disability insurance start? And capping your days so that it's a...
Yeah, right now it's 180 days, so it's a big number. That's why you...
Okay.
That's why we kept it at 960 hours. We don't have short-term.
Okay.
And what can you accrue up to?
960 hours.
How many?
960 hours.
That's when long-term kicks in.
Because that's when long-term
kicks in. Okay, so it's set like that right now. Yeah.
And is that, what do we do at retirement, or is there any kind of payout for sick?
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the number of years you've been here.
There's payout, but it depends on, for operations staff, there's a percentage that's applied to it. So you aren't paid out the total, you're paid out a portion of it.
And it's based on how many years you work.
Sure.
It's a combination of two things. And then for administrative, I get paid out all of it. And, and then you just have something slightly different for clerical.
Is there any way we can get a sense from this person, potential consultant, what it would cost if he came in and we decided not to go with PTO?
Yeah.
As you said, you wouldn't charge the whole fee amount, but I'm wondering what that original information, initial consultation would actually cost.
And is there any way we can look at disability that it's shorter term and then have less accrued vacation?
That was Randy's idea about the short-term disability, right?
Yeah.
And that would certainly be something that he could look look at as well, because I know the some consultant. Communities have done short term, some have not, so it just is a mix again.
Can you find out from him what it would cost for him to come up here and start the conversations, and then we can chart a direction for whether it be a short term disability policy or PTO?
Well, and a lot of times with PTO does come an option for short term disability, so it's not an either or.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But he would be able to. I'm just
there's so many permutations.
To, right.
Yeah.
Give us all that. And then we need to get moving. It's not going to be long before the first of the year. Anything further?
What was decided that we were going to ask him to come in?
No. She was going to see what it cost us. If we only went with Part A.
What won't he come in just simply to
make a sales pitch?
He's expecting us to engage him at this point without us having heard him out at all. So, you know, he should be willing to come in and talk with us to tell us what he has to offer for this. You know, I wouldn't hire him for a dollar until he comes and tells us what he's going to do. Not just what he is telling you.
No, absolutely. If you want him to come in, I'm sure he'd be happy to do that. What I was referring to was if he would come and do some of the research and give you some information and come in and say, okay, here's information to give you to make that decision whether you want to go PTO or not. That was what I was referring to. So he would be doing that and kind of saying, here's some options, here's some costs, and then start with that. And then if you decide we're not going PTO, we've decided that's not where we're going to go, then all these other steps in there he wouldn't do. But I would assume that he would be happy to come in and explain to you what he would do for you and what kind of options there would be available. And I could get him, you know, to do a quote on just, you know, the full cost, you know, what he's got listed here, and then how much approximately if he came in and did that first step to help you guys make that first decision. And there
so
maybe
really
it would be
analyzation and then implementation.
Right. Yes. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
I'd
state it.
Yeah. I'd be interested in seeing what's on the shelf as well. I presume you'd look to see what the league has, you know, relative to PTO experience in the state and other municipalities. What is the Administrator Association? What is that?
Wisconsin City Managers Association, WCMA.
Yeah, you know, is there stuff available through them as well? Yeah, I'd like to be able to contrast and compare.
The county went to that in the last few years.
Bellevue.
Maybe it was just last year. I'm not even sure.
Bellevue did.
Bellevue just went to it last year. So there are communities.
So when Aaron was here. Pardon?
When Aaron
was there.
Right before he left, they put it in.
And they're for the hills.
Yeah, but they're going to
Okay, so you can invite him up to give his basically an explanation of, and then if we decide to go forward with him, we'll want a quote of what it would cost if we had an initial analysis done and then decided not to go down the implementation path. Okay, good. Thank you. A 2014 proposed budget schedule.
We put together a proposed schedule that you have in front of you. It's very similar to what's been done in previous years. We're looking at having two budget workshops, and one could be October 28th and October 30th. And then there's an additional two if we need them. Then we look at having budget hearings November 26th. I know there is a board meeting November 19th, so we could aim for that one, but as will be November 26th. And then as a reminder, everyone has those budget binders that we have in the previous years, and everyone could bring those in so that we could review the budget and the dividers.
You can tell you're new here because you have the if needed in parentheses every hour.
Last year we did, though. Remember, we did it 2 last year.
I'm teasing. Yeah, we did it in 2 last year. This looks great to me. Any feedback or recommendations?
Any concerns with the dates, you guys, for the budget hearings? Our budget workshops, I should say, that someone knows that's not going to work for them.
What days are those?
I think it's
November 4th and 6th are a Monday and a Wednesday. And October 28th is a Monday. And the 30th is a Wednesday.
November 4th is a Packer Bear Monday night game.
Oh. So we did that one year.
It might be well attended.
I think we did that one year.
Is that October?
So we should go after before the game or after?
We'll meet at Lambeau is what you're saying, right?
Right. The tailgate.
I'm sorry, Trustee Zeller?
I was just wondering if October 30th was Halloween as far as...
It's no, 31st.
That it's, okay.
31st.
So if that would be the 31st, that it would be officially Halloween.
Yeah. Might be All Saints Day. Or All Souls Day.
And Steve, I'm assuming that you would like to do meet with the department heads again and go over like we did last year.
Yeah, I think it worked pretty well.
In the week of October 7th, we wanted to do that, so if that's a problem for you, let us know on that too.
I I'm going to be here. Tracy, can you send out Outlook requests for this, please? Very helpful. Anything else? Okay. Is there a motion to adjourn? Trustee Dart, second Trustee Green. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Whoa.
Adjourned.
No closed session?
Oh. Too late. We're adjourned from open session. Is there a motion to convene into closed session?
We're going to withdraw those motions.
I withdraw that motion to adjourn.
We had a goal.
All right, let's start over.
Is there a motion to convene into closed session pursuant to 19.851E, conducting other specified business, specifically hiring a consultant for staff training and proposal for the All Village Hall site? Trustee Green, second Trustee Dart. No, wait, Trustee Dart, second Trustee Green. Roll, please. Trustee Kokrish.
Aye.
Trustee Dendrich.
Aye.
Trustee Green.
Aye.
Aye. Trustee
Aye.
Dart.
Aye.
We're in closed session.